Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire has died. Maurice White had Parkinson's disease for many years. He died at his home here in Los Angeles at the age of 74. NPR's Ted Robbins has this appreciation.
Earth, Wind, and Fire's lush sound and upbeat lyrics were the essence of R&B and disco in the 1970s and 80s. Shining Star was the group's first number one hit in 1974. Maurice White wrote it, as he did most of the group's hits. He was born in Memphis in 1941 and moved to Chicago as a session drummer for Chess Records. Eventually, he moved to L.A., where he formed Earth, Wind, and Fire. In an interview for Fender Rhodes, he said his songwriting drew from jazz, blues, and gospel.
And I would take the music that was very complicated chord-wise, and I put very simple hooks on it. And then would draw the ear. So that's really what my thing's all about.
He drew your ear all right. Those songs and more won Earth, Wind, and Fire 6 Grammys and a place in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Maurice White also worked with other artists, from Weather Report to Barbara Streisand to Cher. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's in the late 1980s, but he stayed active, touring until the mid-90s and running his production company, Kalimba. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, February 10th, 2016, so I have been told. I think I told folks this past weekend when we were talking about Maurice White, founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire, him passing, that we were going to make time to talk about his monumental efforts and how that relates to the system of racism, that we were going to make time to do that this week. And I thought it would be grand to have one of our previous guests back on the program to give his insight. He hosted Night Talk, the first nationally broadcast black talk radio program. He also is the filmmaker, produced Saying It Loud, which gives great information on the history, power of black music. Really great to have him back on the program. I know a lot of folks who heard him when he visited with us last year just had rave reviews, and we're looking forward to him returning to the broadcast. Glad to have him back with us for a second time, Mr. Bob Law. Mr. Law, are you with us, sir? Mr. Law, can you hear us okay?
I can hear you.
Outstanding. Everything great. Great to have you back with us, sir. Pleasure to get you on the program to get some of your thoughts. Anything that you want, in case this might be folks' first time hearing from you, anything that you want to make sure you share so they know about the work that you've done over the years?
Well, I just want to cooperate with your format. Deal with what you were dealing with. That'll be fine. whatever comes to mind.
Outstanding. Before we get to Maurice White, right at the beginning of the year, a huge loss, third-generation physician Dr. Francis Kress Welsing. When you were with us last year, you talked about when you were doing the outstanding broadcast Night Talk that you had Dr. Francis Kress Welsing on your program. Is that correct?
Sure. Number of times, yes.
Wow. What was the response in terms of when you were bringing her on back then? I'm sure this had to be just her talking about her theory of white genetic annihilation in the 70s. What was the response when you were bringing her on?
By the time she was on Night Talk, she had already been established as a credible, trusted authority, very much respected. But we met Francis Kress Welsing. When I started in the radio in the early 70s doing a Sunday afternoon talk show called Black Dialogue. And at that time, not many people around the country were aware of Dr. Welsing. And I remember that there was a guy, a white social scientist, I guess he's, I don't know if he's really a social scientist, had a theory about black people being innately inferior. And so when he talked about black people being inferior, at a time when black people were pushing for equal treatment, he was widely received. He's very much steps into the same mindset that Donald Trump exists in right now. You know, Trump's acceptance is not a new thing among white people. Whenever there's someone who attempts to demonize a demagogue and claim that whites are best suited for special privilege, they are widely received, are warmly received. And this man, I forgot his name, William Shockley. I forgot him already. And we tracked the general manager at the radio station when I was working. It was a black radio station, but that was in the day when there were few black general managers, and we had to really struggle with the white general manager to allow Francis Welsing to debate Shockley, and particularly based on her, at that time, the Kress theory of color confrontation. And that was our first meeting. We talked, we interviewed her a lot. We had to struggle with the white general manager. People were not, even black people at Howard University were not warmly embracing Dr. Welsing. And so that was the beginning. We were there, I was there, and starting with Dr. Welsing right in the early days of her career and of her going beyond Washington, D.C. But by the time I did Night Talk, there was no questioning her credibility, her credentials. There was no questioning her authenticity, and she was firmly established as a credible voice and raising some really significant issues. You know, there's a friend of mine who's a therapist, a clinical therapist, and she says that a serious problem in the black community right now is the issue of mental health. And Frantz Fanon pointed out that oppression will drive you crazy. If you don't really fight back, if you don't move to throw off the oppressor, if you make up all the other kinds of behaviors and attitudes that allow you to, oppression to become normalized, which is what a great many black people do, it'll really drive you crazy. It'll have you saying, you'll be black saying that you don't want reparation. You know, you'll be black and say that you don't think that anybody should repair the damage that institutionalized racism has caused in this society to black people. You'll be black and say you don't even think that that damage should be repaired. You'll be crazy. And Francis Welsing, in dealing with the roots of inappropriate behavior based on what racism does and color consciousness does, and dealing with the inappropriate behavior that white supremacy creates. Her work is even now not fully understood. That is not understood, but the importance and the significance of her work even now is not fully understood, as she began to address the mental illness that really does exist within the community, within any community of oppressed people, particularly when the people don't even realize that they are suffering. And so she made a major contribution, woke a lot of people up, and helped us to understand what the kind of psychological environment we were trapped in.
Ashe, absolutely. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, we were fortunate to have her on the program many times over the years. Huge loss, and we'll continue to have our remembrance and appreciation of her scholarship. It has been just a really tough 2016 already, and the year really just started not shortly after Dr. Frances Cress Welsing passed, just last Wednesday evening, the transition of Earth, Wind, and Fire founder Maurice White. And I'm sure there are some people, particularly younger people, who maybe they only know Earth, Wind, and Fire from songs like September or Boogie Wonderland that, you know, people play at weddings and parties and that sort of thing. And they might be saying, you know, well, what does Maurice White have to do with racism? Yeah, you know, it's sad that he passed and, you know, great musician. They did a lot of wonderful music. But what does that have to do with racism? Your response would be?
Well, you know, part of the reality is that almost everything is affected by and operates within the context of institutionalized racism in the society. And it operates within the context of white supremacy. A black musician is very much a victim of race in America. It's one of the reasons that musicians leave this country. Years ago, Max Roach and his wife at that time, Abby Lincoln, went to Japan, and when they came back, Abby wrote a poem. And the poem said, "Japan, Japan, good for my man." And in the poem, he talks about how Max was so well received and treated with such great respect. And people acknowledge, you know, Max Roach might have been the greatest drummer of all time. And people in Japan acknowledged that and applauded that and treated him like he was a special talent, a gift among us. And so she said, "Japan was good for my man." At the end of the poem, it said, "But was it good for my man? Because he had to come back to America." And then after having been experienced the treatment and the recognition that he deserved, you come back to America, and you run into American racism, and you are reminded that of what racism and white supremacy actually operates, how it actually operates, and how it sets out to demean and diminish your talent, diminish your worth, even though you are a spectacular human being or a spectacular talent, so that any musician, Maurice White, Dennis Edwards, David Ruffin, you know, any Smokey Robinson, any musician, and even before that, Billie Holiday and Billy Eckstein, and, you know, those performers, Della Reese and Carmen McRae, you know, they, you know, Sarah Vaughan is perhaps the finest female vocalist ever. But Sarah Vaughan could not have, but she never made Barbara Streisand money. But she can sing better than anybody on the planet. But the opportunities, and because I heard Lou Donaldson in an interview a few days ago say how this music industry is so structured that it has very little to do with your talent. He talked about a woman who sings off-key who had a hit record. And he talked about other musicians and he named Kenny G and people who are making enormous money having hit records, having TV specials, going on tours, and they are by no means the finer or the finest performers or musicians in the industry. It is how this industry is structured. You know, there's a book called Rhythm in Business talking about R&B, and it's R&B music. It's called Rhythm in Business, the political economy of black music, and it is indeed a political economy. The political economy, as you know, is the economy that is created based on political decisions, based on policy. You know, there are people who become millionaires not as a result solely of talent, but as a result of the policy decisions that are made that affect their careers and affect their lives. So there's a handful of people who really emerge, and there's so many other people of equal talent and maybe sometimes even greater talent who don't prosper to the same extent. So Earth, Wind & Fire steps into a music environment that was being not totally controlled, but it was a certain kind of music because we make such wonderful music. So rhythm and blues is such wonderful music. You know, people making that kind of music, and that music, soul music, and then funk, if we're talking about popular music. And that, there's almost not really a formula, but to some extent, there's a certain kind of music that is being accepted as really very good music, but it's the music that we kind of thought that black people would do and would appreciate. Then you get Earth, Wind & Fire, or a group like La Belle, and you look at their music, began to particularly, well, both of them, but Earth, Wind & Fire, using different sets of instruments. There's one little instrument coming out of Africa called a kalimba that Earth, Wind & Fire use. It's almost like a handheld piano. You know, it's a little small instrument that, but it was a, you know, it didn't have a funky bottom, didn't have an organ sound, you know, and then, but they had a music that stretched the boundaries, and they stretched the boundaries, they introduced newer rhythms from around, from their experience, from the black experience in the world. They included more music. They stretched the boundaries. They changed the message to some extent, so that their music reflected a global consciousness. And when black people heard it, it struck a responsive chord with us, like we already had that global consciousness in our hearts. And they struck that chord and took the music and took the music out beyond where it was being developed and practiced at that time. And they came with a new whole look. At that time, performers, you know, when you went to a concert back in the 70s, late 60s even, but when you went to a concert, the performers dressed like they knew you were coming. You know, they got dressed up too. They, you know, they came out on stage and their look was all part of their performance. It wasn't, they respected their audience, and so they were entertaining you, and they were on every level. They looked the part, they sound the part, you know, they packaged themselves. Their look was a billboard for what they believed. If they were the Temptations, they were tall, tantalizing, well-groomed, tuxedos, haircut, you know, shoes shining, tight choreography. That's what they represented. They represented young black men trying to make it in the world, in control of themselves, in control of their lives. They look good. They look the part. These are the black men who you would want your daughter to bring home. You know, these are the black men who you saw walking down the street and you felt good as they were representing their people. And if it was Earth, Wind, and Fire, then these were the young men who were just as stylish, just as polished, looked just as good, but they took it to another level, you know, and they made it clear that we exist culturally on a number of levels, and all of them are stylish, and all of them are to be, all of those levels are to be respected. And in doing so, it could antagonize whites who wanted to keep black folk in a particular box, who wanted to contain and control particularly the black music industry. And here were these guys saying that we are going to legitimize, we're going to take all of our music, put it out in the universe. We're going to, and see, they're doing music that really can't be so easily imitated. You know, Roy Ayers did an album saying Africa was the center of the world, and the record company told him that he could not say that on the album cover. So the album cover said Africa. It said the center of the world, and there was a little map of Africa in that line of copy. But they wouldn't allow him to actually say Africa is the center of the world. And that's because they have an agenda of ownership and control, not only of the music, but control of the culture. They would attempt to define how the historical legacy of black people in the world. And so, you know, a group like Earth, Wind, and Fire, a group like LaBelle, pushing the limits, demanding that you hear us on our terms, that was a very powerful thing for them to do, and a very courageous thing for them to do, because they were challenging the norms that had been constructed for what it was that black people could do at that time.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. I know when you were with us before, and one of the really important points that you shared on that broadcast was that a lot of times black people who are entertainers, musicians, think that they are in the record-selling business. And you said, no, you are in the idea-selling business. And just to really highlight some of the points that you just made in regards to Maurice White being the founder and pace setter for Earth, Wind, and Fire, what messages, what ideas was he attempting to transmit to black people, both not just with the music, when you hear songs like Keep Your Head to the Sky, and I know one of our listeners, retired firefighter in Florida, he always mentions Devotion and Mighty Mighty, and not just the music that they were doing in that time period, but even if you look at the album covers, and they've got the pyramids, and as you said, dignified black people, and their connection to African spirituality, what sort of messaging were they communicating to black people with their music and performance?
One of the powerful messages was, we didn't just fall out of the sky. We have a legacy. We have a culture. We are connected to a glorious African presence in the world. So, because when they do the pyramids, it recognizes, it doesn't simply make kind of a mystic statement, like they are tapping into the power of the pyramid. It is saying that we recognize from whence we come. We recognize that our music didn't begin with us, that this music began with our ancestors, and that they made it clear that they were part of a tradition, that they inherited a legacy that had a cultural and even a political responsibility to keep your face to the sky. You know, the messages in the lyrics were very important messages at the time, because then as now, black people are under attack and many black people don't realize it. But the music is one of the most powerful communication tools that we've ever had. You know, music strikes a responsive chord with all of what the music does. The music, the rhythms, the texture, you know, the tone of it, all of it is very, very important. And Maurice White seemed to clearly understand. He seemed to clearly understand what it was, kind of looking for a statement that I had done that talked about the music. But, you know, coming out of the Black Arts Movement, for instance, one of the things that, and I think Maurice White understood that, one of the things that the Black Arts Movement said about the music was that the music represents the form of our experience in the world. You know, our music has always been a manifestation of who we are and how we feel. And it is the music that is so crucial to expressing what's in our hearts and minds. And the music does it better than anything else. And Maurice White understood that. And, you know, so Earth, Wind, and Fire, real quick, I need to find my glasses while we're talking, so I can. I wanted to just share this quote from Confucius with you. Confucius said that if you should desire to know if a kingdom is well governed, if its morals are good or bad, the quality of its music will furnish the answer. And that is absolutely true. It's when you look at the or listen to the music and even look at music that was being performed at any particular time, within any particular time frame. You know, you look at the music of the 1950s, and that music is rhythmic and do-up-to-do, smooth and rhythmic. It kind of reflected how Black people felt at that time. Then you listen to the music of the 60s, and the music of the 60s now is the boogaloo, and it's more defiant, and it's more shotgun, shoot them while they run now. You know, it's James Brown with your bad self. You know, the music now has another tone. The music always reflected where the people were at philosophically. And Larry Neal, who was one of the architects of the Black Arts Movement, has said that our music has always been the most dominant manifestation of what we are and how we feel. The best of it has always operated at the very core of our lives. It is the music that can affirm our highest possibilities. And when, see, there are some people who can't read, for instance, you know, as we go all the way back and people listening to music, but they could hear the message in the music. You know, there are some people who never went to a political rally, never went to church, never heard Jeremiah Wright speak. You know, some people who have just not really paying attention on a conscious political level, but they're listening to the music. And the music is saying, keep your head to the sky. You know, the music has got the messages that are teaching you that there's some value in devotion, and explaining for you what devotion means. That the music is important to understand that in this society, music conveys social status. See, being associated with a certain kind of music can increase your social standing. Now, you remember this, consider the higher level of sophistication associated with opera, or what Europeans call classical music, or the level of cool sophistication associated with the music of Coltrane, Monk, Miles. See, it is not only the music that we like, it is the company the music puts us in. You know, in this sense, the music creates a community or lifestyle that is validated by the acceptance of the music. So nowadays, it's the music that validates gangster and killing and disregarding and disrespecting women. But Earth, Wind, and Fire, even in choosing the name Earth, Wind, and Fire, calling on, suggesting by the very name of the group that they are calling on the essential elements that make the universe move, you know, that energize the universe. And then the lyrics and the direction that the music is going, and to identify with them is to put you in the company of enlightened, truth seekers, progressive, cutting edge thinkers. That's what the music does. And that's the company that the music puts you in. And Maurice White seemed to understand that and made a point to nourish his people and nourish the spirit of his people by deliberately creating life-giving and nourishing music. And I think that is something that gets overlooked. There are other performers who are doing the same thing. They just feel it. You know, they just kind of feel it. They just do what they feel is right. And they know, and sometimes they don't know how right they are. But I think that Maurice White understood his opportunity as a music maker to nourish the very spirit of his people. And of course, see, Earth, Wind, and Fire would point out that they made music for everybody, and everybody can listen to and benefit from hearing that music. But it's like Toni Morrison, who just recently said, "I write for black people without apology." You know, when everybody can appreciate a Maya Angelou poem, but when Maya Angelou says, "Still I rise," there may be a lot of other people who say, "Yeah, I can relate to that." But her own people feel that, sense that in a different and more profound way because of our experience in this society. And even though Earth, Wind, and Fire made the music really for everybody, but they came from a cultural base that was particularly meaningful for black people. And I always felt that Maurice White understood that.
Context of White Supremacy, our guest, Mr. Bob Law. If folks have a quick question that you want to get in, Mr. Law has a full schedule, so he's not able to stay with us for the full program. But if you have a quick question that you want to get in, feel free, chime in, get your hand up. Just even connecting the two, we started off talking about Dr. Francis Cress Welsing and then with Maurice White. What are your thoughts in terms of the concerted effort? I know we talked about last time, and you've done a prolific amount of commentary and writing on the war, the attack against black media outlets, black radio, where you don't have a platform, talk radio platform for Dr. Francis Cress Welsing to come and give her views. You don't have a platform for a Maurice White, the next generation of Nina Simone's or Earth, Wind, and Fire to give that nourishing, uplifting music to black people. Can you just speak to the efforts to make sure that we do not have the next generation of these type of black scientists, black performers?
Well, I'm not quite clear the question for me.
Let's see if I can simplify it. You would need a platform, black radio, black talk radio. You would need a platform for Dr. Welsing to come and speak or to hear the music of Earth, Wind, and Fire, Maurice White. And I'm asking, can you comment on the current racist attack to make sure that that platform doesn't exist so that you're not able to hear the next generation of Earth, Wind, and Fire? You don't have the platform so that Dr. Welsing can come and speak to black people now.
You know, black people have been removed, or black thought, black intellectual property, black intellectual capital has been removed from the marketplace of ideas. But with the elimination of black media, and with the elimination particularly of conscious black media, and conscious black media replaced with frivolous media, frivolous black media, frivolous morning radio, all radio, disrespectful radio, people cursing and using the N-word and talking about in a derogatory and degrading manner about women, those are the people who have made the degradation of black people normal. They have bought into the degradation of black people and have attempted to normalize degradation. And that's what Dr. Elisa English is talking about when she talks about the mental health issue in the black community. You have people who are on the radio now who really are suffering from a mental imbalance to use the language that they use and to think that that is keeping it real. See, that's insanity without fully understanding it. And it is because what Asa Hilliard has identified as cultural surrender. It's when you allow someone else to define your humanity, to define who you are, and change your language, change your language in terms of how you speak about each other, how you talk to each other. That phenomena reflects the kind of mental illness that is a result of refusing to fight back against oppression, not fully understanding white supremacy, and now attempting to normalize oppression, degradation, and white supremacy, so that, and in order to be able to do that, you've got to take the strident black voices off the air. You've got to take the black intellectual capital out of the equation. You've got to remove black critical thought, creative thought, innovative thought. You've got to take those real ideas out of the marketplace of ideas. And that is absolutely what has happened without people fully understanding it, because they're still hearing black voices, even though the things that the black voices say are irrelevant, harmful, anti-black, anti-woman, anti-life itself. And without realizing it, it's what happens when the oppressor gets inside your head. And the oppressor doesn't even have to be present. The oppressor gets inside your head, and then you will call your own women out of their name. You'll have lyrics like this song by, I think the guy's name is Schoolboy. He said, "I got a shotgun, and here's the plot. Taking niggas out with a flurry of your buckshot. Yeah, I was gunning, and then you look up, and all you see is niggas running." And that glorifies killing your own people. That normalizes your N-word. It normalizes murder. It normalizes killing your own people. And there are people who pretend that I'm just keeping it real. But that is not keeping it real. And it is not the function of an artist to keep it real. The function of an artist is to create the new reality. So if your reality is pimps and hoes, and that's what you see on the street, your challenge and your responsibility as an artist is to write songs like Maurice White, to write songs that lift you above the gutter, to write songs and perform songs that take you to a higher consciousness. See, any baby can look out the window and say, "This is what I see." Or any non-talent person, a person with no talent whatsoever, can just walk outside and you can say to that person, "Write me a little essay about what you see when you walk down the street." And I see drug addicts, and I see, gang banging, and I see this, and they just say what they see. It doesn't take any genius, any brains, or any talent to do that. The talent is when you walk down those same streets and you write lyrics that say, "Keep on pushing for higher ground." See, when the talent is when you write lyrics that say, "Keep your face to the sky." When you don't reflect the reality that was created for you by people who hold you in contempt, your function as an artist, as a critical thinker, as a thought leader, is not to just reflect what you see, but to present, not what you see, but what you can be. And that's what is missing when you take black thought out of the marketplace of ideas and replace it with underdeveloped Negro thought. But see, when I'm off the air, it's not just that Bob Law is not on the air. When there's no Night Talk, and I'm not on the air 5 days a week, now that means you don't hear from Francis Wilson regularly. You hear from Francis Wilson regularly on the Carl Nelson Show on WOL in Washington, D.C. You know, and Carl Nelson is like one of the last progressive talk show people that we have who's on a daily basis. You know, Gary Bird is on in New York City, but Bird is on 1 day a week. But when I'm not on the air, that means that Marlana Coringa is not on the air anymore. You know, that means that it, all the people that you used to hear coming through Night Talk, Sonia Sanchez is also not on the air. Kenny Gamble is not on the air. All the people that I talked to, Dr. Claude Anderson is not on the air. The people that you were being introduced to that you didn't know about, Ollie Gates in Kansas City, an extraordinary black entrepreneur with a real commitment, conscious commitment to his community. But any number of things and people are no longer in the marketplace of ideas where you don't get an opportunity to hear and sample our ideas to help you decide how you want to move forward. And the only way it's going to change, if we're dealing with commercial media, and commercial media is still the most significant, the most important. That's why people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, and I don't know the names of all those other people, they are on AM radio stations all over the country. They are talking to thousands of people on a daily basis, 5 days a week. Got thousands of people every 15 minutes. Radio is measured in quarter-hour shares. They are talking to people, and thousands of people coming in to hear them every 15 minutes because they're on commercial radio, and they get paid very, very well. What we are told is to go to alternative media where you don't get paid at all and leave the prosperity to the white supremacists. Let them have the airwaves. Let them have all the money. Let their families prosper and do very well. And we are looking for ways that we can keep getting the word out of love of our out of the love for our people. But we're like WURD, the black-owned talk station in Philadelphia. It has made a strong commitment to serving the black community, but it doesn't make the kind of money that the stations that bewilder black people make. And see, that's what we have to change, and that comes from the audience. It's one of the things that we've been working on. I'm about to run out of time. It's one of the things that we've been working on that Dr. King asked us to do the night before he was murdered in Memphis, where he said that, you know, the next thing we have to do is to direct our external direct action, or best to anchor our external direct action with the strategy of economic withdrawal. We've got to see, with all of the money that McDonald's and Burger King make from black people, see, it is outrageous, black people, that you would complain about not having any voice and no outlets for the scholars and thinkers among us who really love us, that you would complain that they are removed from the marketplace. But you don't demand that McDonald's, Burger King, spend money on black-owned media to keep that media afloat the way they spend money on white-owned media in order to make white-owned radio prosperous. With all of the money that black people are spending on burgers and french fries, aside from the fact that food is toxic and harmful and poisonous and causing type 2 diabetes and obesity, heart disease among black youth, aside from that, which ought to be enough reason in itself for you to stop eating it.
Amen.
But in addition to that, they don't put any money back into the black community in a meaningful way. They give silly little charitable donations, you know, gospel concerts that they make the money from. You know, they with all of the money that is being spent by black people. How is it if young black men are so important that Nike does not spend any money in black media? No commercials on black radio. No commercials in black-owned newspapers. With all of the money that young black men and older black men are spending on Nike, so you don't demand that people reinvest in our community in a meaningful way, so they take us for granted. And we like to talk about how we spend over $1 trillion a year, and we spend over $1 trillion, and we're spending even more, and it's going up every year. And so what happens is that black marketing people, like the people out in Chicago, I forgot the name of the research company that publishes the spending, what is called the spending power, Target Market News, the Ken Smichael, those guys at Target Market, they like to point out that black people are spending all of this money and go to white corporations and say, you know, black people are spending all this money on cola, spending all this money on sneakers, and all this money on this and that, and that we can show you how much money we spend. Based on how much money we spend, you ought to put money back into some black media, right? That is a silly argument. The Nike and McDonald's and Pepsi, and whoever you go to, they say, if we are receiving so much of your money and we don't put any money in the black community, and we're receiving all this money that you just told us about, well, why do we need to put any money back? We're giving your money as it is. So see, the message ought to be to black people, stop spending your money. Hold on to your dollars. Economic withdrawal, as Dr. King said, and say to these corporations, we want to see black people back in the marketplace of ideas. And so we want you to take a radio station like WURD. We're saying, we should be saying to McDonald's and Burger King and Nike and Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and whoever else it is, Maxwell, all the products that black people buy, we ought to be saying to them, spend money on that radio station, make it prosperous the way you have done for all other white-owned media, or we will stop spending our money with you. You have to use our dollars strategically and use it as a political tool in order to influence policy. You can't impress people with how much you spend, and that's why they ought to treat you differently. You will have to show them how much you are willing not to spend, how much of their profit you will affect by withholding your dollars. And that alone, and that is what it would take, rather, that is what it will take to change policy. And so to put us back into the marketplace of ideas, it will mean making black media viable again. Right now, black media is not viable. If you owned a black radio, if you were black and you owned a radio station, you're going to struggle. You're not going to make any money. You might be the station owner, but it's just like having a job. There are people who work for a corporation who are better off than the person who owns the black radio station, the black person who owns a small black radio station. Somebody working for American Express, like Brother Ken Chenault, he's better off financially, personally, than the owners of a lot of, there's not a lot anymore, but he's better off financially than many of the few black folk who still own a radio station. In New York City, the legacy black radio station, WWRL, not making any money for years and years. It's just been sold to an Asian entrepreneur. It's going to turn it into a, it's already a Spanish language station. It's going to turn it into an Asian language station. The black people who owned it, they're not as well off as Ken Chenault at American Express. They're not as well off as the Dick Parsons when he was working for Time, Life, Warner, whoever he was working for. We have to change that and make being a black entrepreneur in a sensitive arena or area like media, we have to make black media viable. So that there's no point in telling saying things like, we're going to build our own radio station. We have our own radio station and are losing them weekly, daily, not daily, but certainly weekly, monthly. We are losing them and losing them because at this point, black media is not a viable investment. And it's not viable because the audience allows the corporate America to take us for granted, take our dollars for granted, and refuses. They don't even refuse. They just ignore. They refuse by just ignoring us and don't put any money back. That is what has to be changed.
Really profound thoughts from Mr. Bob Law, talk show host for Night Talk, again, the first nationally broadcast Black Talk radio platform, and his documentary film, Saying It Loud. Again, real pleasure to have you back on the program. Appreciated you giving some insight on Earth, Wind, and Fire, and its founder, Maurice White, just transitioned last week. Hopefully we can have you back on the program again soon to continue to address some of these issues and get some strategies for things that we can to try to solve some of these problems. But again, thank you so much, Mr. Law. Please enjoy the rest of it.
All right, now, thank you for having me. Okay.
Absolutely. You. Take care, sir. Context of White Supremacy. Again, Mr. Bob Law, if you didn't hear him the first time that he was on the program, it was the spring of 2015. You can go back in the archives where he gives a lot more of the history of black radio in this area of the world, connecting that to the 60s and 70s, what was happening in the quote-unquote civil rights movement, and even some of the commentary from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When he was talking to the National Association of Talk Radio Broadcasters and just talking about the huge importance of black radio. Really great information. Again, it's back in spring of 2015. It's linked in the description for this program. For the folks who are listening at Black Talk Radio Network, you'll see it right there. You can just click his name and it should pop up. I'll post it again on Facebook and Twitter if folks want to go back and check that out as well. He wasn't able, as I said, he wasn't able to hang out with us for the full program. So folks, I did see folks who dialed in who had hands up. Sorry we weren't able to get your question, but he had a pretty full schedule, but was able to carve out a chunk of time to get in. If he had had a bit more time, I was going to ask him about Natalie Cole as well, because she also just transitioned. As I said, the year just started, and it has been absolutely awful just within the first, it's not even a month and a half of 2016. But I was going to bring that up just because, as he touched on, black mental health. For people who listen to the program that we did, what they call New Year's Eve, the wrap up, the last day of 2015. And I said that that is the thing, in my view, that we should really be paying attention to: black mental health, really at all times, but particularly this year. My assessment, 2015 looked horrendous, and really, according to logic, every year is horrendous under the system of white supremacy. But this, just everything about this looks particularly bad, as though racists really have some just a lot of intense and vicious attacks planned for black people on all fronts worldwide. But he commented on mental health, and I was going to ask him about Natalie Cole and her passing away this year. I believe she was in her mid-60s, I think 65. I could be inaccurate with the exact year, but I know she was not very old. She was, you know, mid-60s. That is way too young to be transitioning, where she could have been doing more with her art, singing, anything, you know, just living her life and doing more. And I was just going to ask in connecting that to black mental health, because obviously she was Nat King Cole's daughter. Incredible performer, would be a part of that legacy that Bob Law was just talking about. I mean, particularly you talk about black people being dignified and, you know, not on I'm a gangster and I'm a thug and, you know, every other word is some filth and profanity. I mean, you talk about 180 degree diametric opposite would be Nat King Cole. Polished, stylish, I mean, incredible performer, probably one of the best voices of all time. He was terrorized relentlessly for the duration of his career. I think we played the sound clip when she transitioned, Natalie Cole. We played one of the interviews that she gave where she was talking about what her family endured, where they would come and set arson on their property, burn the rose bushes, they poisoned their dog, I think they burned nigger in their lawn. I mean, just terrorism, ongoing terrorism amongst the white. These are their neighbors. These are presumably people that when they leave, you know, hey, Todd, Helen, Susan, these are the folks that are right around them on a daily basis. And this was what they were subjected to. And, you know, I submit that that has a huge impact on your mental health. That's why you end up with black people having all these health conditions and dying at an early age. You connect that with Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing as well. I would even Maurice White as well. But that is a huge aspect of when Dr. Welsing, when she would say black people do not qualify for mental health, we probably have no idea the toll that white supremacy takes on us, in addition to everything else, having toxified water and Flint and everywhere else and the toxic food. And I mean, it's just a constant barrage. But I'm really, really glad that he brought that up. And, you know, hopefully we can make more time for addressing that in a serious manner. But I cannot emphasize that enough. Black mental health, that should really be in the forefront of our minds moving through this year, 2016. Just as I said, I think it's going to be a very unpleasant, would be putting it mildly, heinous year. That's what I expect for these next, 10 and a half months. On that note, there was a report of a Black Lives Matter activist who allegedly shot himself outside the Ohio State House. I'll certainly make time for folks to comment. If you have anything you want to share on Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire, we'll certainly we'll have time to do that. But just on the same note, I know people were talking about this. This young black male, 23-year-old black male, Marshawn M. McCarroll II, who it's reported, and I can only say allegedly because at least from this report, no one saw him shoot himself. So, you know, you can always put an asterisk down if this is the way it really happened. If someone else shot him, that certainly could be. But at least right now, it's being reported as a suicide. And they have some Twitter posts and social media posts that Mr. McCarroll allegedly made prior to his death. And I think one of them where it says, "My demons won today. I'm sorry." If that is what happened, that's the way that this is being reported, it would just be another instance. I know there are people who take the position that, you know, they don't think this was a suicide. That could be. But I definitely, this would be another aspect. And I would add to that, because I was talking to a listener yesterday, for any of the folks, anybody, if you're a black person and you make studying, talking about, researching, committing a sizable portion of your time to really dealing with racism, white supremacy, just that in and of itself is stressful. It's not like this is, you know, fun material to look at and talk about, to see how black people have been and continue to be terrorized worldwide. That's not exactly pleasant material. Just that in and of itself has an impact on you, regardless of whether it's, you know, black people that you know, or this is something that happened a long time ago. Just that alone has an impact on your health and well-being. It is very, very important to really take care of yourself, to monitor how are you feeling. I think he talked about, and I've seen a lot of people talk about with Maurice White, in saying that just their music alone was something that was really important for black mental health. I saw a black writer, Jason King, who wrote a really solid piece at NPR in memoriam for Maurice White. And he said that he feels better just thinking about Earth, Wind, and Fire, much less listening to the music. But I don't even think, and I know Dr. Rasa, Niana Rasayan, he's talked about this as well, the importance of music, how that can do a lot for your mental health and well-being, particularly for Black people. And I just think the environment that we're in, it's so saturated. It's beyond just the water. What's coming out of your tap being, what's coming out of your faucet being toxified and poisoned. And what's on your plate being poisoned. What's coming through your speakers? What's in your iPad? What's on your playlist? That too has been toxified, and I would say increasingly over the years. I was even thinking, I was going to ask him, Mr. Law had more time, I was going to ask him if he thinks a group like Earth, Wind, and Fire, if that, you know, would even have a chance of being promoted today. I mean, certainly there are a lot more independent outlets, and, you know, they could, what they call do your own thing, and maybe avoid going through some of the big companies, Sony and Columbia and what have you. But I mean, I even have a hard time thinking if you could get a group like that promoted today with everything else that's out there, what's being pushed and the type of messages and what have you. It would be difficult for me to even fathom that functioning today and them being saying, yeah, we want to invest in this. Keep your head to the sky. Yes, we want to invest in and promote that and have Black people listening to that. Like, wow. But just Black mental health, extremely important. If you can find some music to listen to that kind of helps you replenish your spirit and feel a little bit better, do that. I recommend it if there are things that you enjoy, because I think that's one of the things that racism, white supremacy does. It really obstructs your ability to just enjoy life. If you can find things that you enjoy doing that are constructive, if it's going out and doing a hike, if it's, you know, going to go fishing, maybe you throw them back, but going to go fishing or just going to spend some time at the water, going to the beach, getting some time outside, going skiing, getting some exercise, going running. If it's family members that you enjoy spending time with, going to kick it with your grandfather, grandmother, if you have siblings or what have you, really make time to do that, because I think this system, it does a tremendous job of just taking those things away so that you don't want to do them, or even just removing them, period, so that you're not able to do them. We've bought this beach, so no, you can't come here anymore. This is private property now. You can't go here, you can't fish here, you can't do anything. And if you do come, you're trespassing. We'll have you locked up. Just doing those sorts of things so that we have fewer and fewer things to do, but really make an effort to try to find things that you enjoy doing that are constructive. I cannot highlight that enough, because they will direct you to, oh, you feel bad? You know, we're legalizing cannabis. How about, you know, go get a few buds and you can, you know, have a session. You'll feel better. Or here, go get a glass of wine. You'll feel better. Go get a fifth of this. You'll feel better. They do that sort of thing. It might even be heroin might be coming down the pike, since they're saying all these white people are addicted to heroin. Might be that. Here, we have legalized heroin now, so here, you can go and shoot up. You'll feel better. Here, go sit down. Scandal is back on. You'll feel better. Turn the television on, and you can veg out that way. They will present a lot of options that are not constructive, that are really not going to replenish your spirit and help you revitalize just under the constant torrent of assault that we're dealing with. But just, I think that's hugely important. And this whole subject matter reminded me of that, both with the loss of Dr. Welsing, Maurice White, Natalie Cole, Dr. Delbert Blair, so many others, this young man, Marshawn Mark Carroll II, but also the music that Earth, Wind, and Fire and the founder, Maurice White, that they provided for Black people, and a wealth of others. I think Nina Simone, there are lots of others who would be in that same boat, Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, lots of other folks who would be in that position of providing really constructive and healthy vibrations for us. But Black mental health, let's please keep that in the forefront for 2016. We'll make sure to do our part here at the Context of White Supremacy to get out more content, more information in that vein. That's it. If folks have anything that they would like to share related to Earth, Wind, and Fire, we will do that first. If you have other topics that you want to bring up, that's fine, but we'll do that later. This is strictly Earth, Wind, and Fire. Maurice White, I think I said this past weekend that, you know, we were going to make time to do that anyway. So, you know, it wasn't like you were missing out if you didn't get to participate in the compensatory call-in from this past Saturday. that you missed out on your chance if you had anything that you wanted to say with regards to Maurice White. I know a lot of our listeners, he had a big impact. Earth, Wind, and Fire had a big impact on them, and they had a lot of appreciation for the music that they provided. So if folks have any commentary related to that or what Mr. Bob Law had to share, if you would like to participate, we'll hit the phone lines. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. My quick addendum, I do not have hard evidence to support this, but I do. There is evidence to support that for young white children, particularly young white males, they get a boost in self-esteem, self-respect from watching television. We had a white female who was a part of this study, did the research a few years back, and I even asked the correlation. To me, it's intuitive. You don't even need to think. It would have to be that for young black people, it would have to be the opposite effect, where it really damages your self-respect, your black self-respect, self-esteem, watching television. I think it would probably be a good idea to really minimize the amount of television that you watch, particularly if you are feeling a little down, and that happens. That, you know, is not a surprise if you're a black person. If you're feeling depressed, you're feeling unhappy, you just feel like your spirit is a little down, it would probably be a good idea to turn the television off, because you are not going to see. My apologies, background noise. Anyway, you're not going to see anything that is affirming of black people. You're not going to see anything that is intended to raise, to improve black self-respect. Absolute opposite. I cannot imagine how sitting down and being deluged with Monsters Ball and Scandal and Precious and The Walking Dead and all the other garbage that they have on television, being Mary Jane, I cannot imagine how any of that is going to make you feel any better about being a black person. Maybe I have just missed out on the good television to watch. This might even go for radio too, unless you're, you know, listening to some constructive content. But if you're just listening to the regular standard white supremacist programming, it's probably not going to do anything good for your black mental health. That would just be a quick addendum. Maybe go and have your own playlist where you know you have some constructive content, or if you have your own you know, viewing material that you know is constructive, that is going to have positive images of black people and things that specifically are designed to reaffirm and boost how you feel about yourself as a black person. Check that out. But it would probably not be in your best interest to just binge out on Netflix or TV. Just an addendum. For the folks who dialed in, again, this is just on Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire right now. And then if folks have anything else that they would like to share, we'll make time for that also. But any of the folks that dialed in have any comments related to what Bob Law shared with us, Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire? The folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us.
Yes, sir. Greetings.
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida. Thought you would be participating on this one.
No doubt. Mr. White, you know, he really meant a lot. I mean, I never met him or anything like that. I've never even seen one of their concerts live, but his music, I first start off by saying that he apparently self-interned himself for a long period of time before he actually started putting out his own ideas exclusively, because from my studies of reading about him, he had a a time in Chess Records, which we know about them from a movie that came out about, I don't know, about 3 or 4 years ago. And he played a long time, you know, in jazz with Ramsey Lewis in that trio. He was a drummer. I mean, in other words, I think he really took his time in really understanding the business, the means of how to perfect his artistic behaviors and talents. And when we finally got to know him, wow, this gentleman helped me get through high school, get me out of high school. And I was not a good student in high school, but it was something about his music that just got a grip on you and just picked you up, just motivated you. And the motivation is almost like you couldn't do nothing on a negative basis. I had to be on a constructive basis, you know. And at that time, I was a lot less confused than I am now. But you know, I mean, the beat, the music, the soft tones, sometimes the louder tones. It was always matched in with some very sophisticated lyrics that went along with it. It wasn't so much about going to church, so to speak, but you know, from a religious standpoint. But it was from such a deep sense of thinking and so positive. I mean, man, you know. And then it did stop through college, you know, with a lot of the music that he had, you know, and was performing in, and along with him. I could be wrong about this. I think the bass player was related to him. I could be wrong about that. And within that band, he was the institution unto himself also, the bass player. I don't know for sure if he was a relative, but I think I heard he was related to him. The horn section in the band was so prestigious, and this was just, I just found out about this the other day when I saw Spike Lee's documentary, what he did on Michael Jackson. They evolved themselves with the Off the Wall album that Michael Jackson did, the horn section of Earth, Wind, and Fire. You know, so it, you know, along with Mr. White, who actually, you know, was the CEO of that band, it was just excellence in the whole band itself, you know. And of course, the voice of the lead singer, you know, and he was gonna turn you. I forgot his name. That's why I haven't mentioned. I just can't think of his name right now. But because I'm so excited about getting a chance to talk about him. But I mean, all around, man, it was just a. It's almost at least once a week that I play Devotion on purpose. If I need a pick me up or something like that, I play that song, the live version of it especially. It was just, you know, just awesome. To connect it with the system of racist white supremacy, as we understand with all of these cuts that are done in public schools. They cut the music sections and the art sections in public school system. So what it does is kind of like shuts the door on a new generation of children to be able to study musical instruments, study the arts and music and different things like that, and to really become professional, so to speak, in what they're saying and doing, to achieve the status that Mr. White set an example for. It's becoming tougher and tougher for kids who do have talent, children who do have talent, to really blossom that talent into something, you know, very strong and very sound and very, very, very much constructive, to whereas when listeners hear their works, hear or see their works, then they would go about their life in doing something constructive. That's what it's all about. The negativity today is based on, in my opinion, programming. It's a sophisticated means of programming. Because if I control what you see and what you hear, I control you. And we certainly got a lot to talk about when it comes to that on how the negative aspects. But I'll end there and let somebody else go on, because I can go on with about Maurice White and Earth, Wind, and Fire. Thank you for listening.
Yes, sir. I think Philip Bailey, was he the other lead for Earth, Wind, and Fire?
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Do other folks dial in have any commentary they wanted to add, what they heard from Mr. Law or pertaining to the late Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers. Yes, I wanted to comment on Maurice White as well as something that Mr. Bob Law also said on the program. Maurice White, for me is interesting because I grew up, my dad basically has every album that they have. He has a huge music collection. So I grew up listening to Earth, Wind, and Fire and the Commodores and all of that stuff like my entire childhood. And he still plays their music to this day. What I think is Maurice White was really tapped into the ancestral reservoir of just the most incredible ability to tap into what he had the most incredible ability to tap into the essence of what black people can strive to become. And I just think like the loss is just profound. And like you said, just for this to be less than a month and a half in the year of 2016, we're going to have a super doozy. And I think we might have talked about this before the year started, that this upcoming year was going to be serious. And it's just the signs are there with losing Natalie Cole, losing Maurice White, losing Dr. Welsing. It's just, you know, it's insane. And it really gives you a lot of pause for thought, especially when you were talking about black mental health. And I was watching last night, I was watching a documentary on Bob Marley. And they were discussing in the documentary that he had trouble getting black people to come to his shows when he came to the United States. And at one point, he actually made set up a show with the Commodores. And if I'm not mistaken, Earth, Wind, and Fire was also on the bill for that night. And it was his way of basically his entree into reaching black people, because he knew that the Commodores had the black audience in a way in which he would be able to tap directly into reaching black people, which was who he was more concerned with, because of the fact that all of his concerts were just a sea of white people when they were sold out. And I just found that really interesting, simply because Bob had to connect with people like the Commodores, like Earth, Wind, and Fire, who had the black psyche and put out such high quality music that he was able to add to that. And I just found that to be very powerful. And it was just, I found it no coincidence that I watched that yesterday and now we're talking about him. So I just found that very interesting. The loss is just unfathomable. And also, when I was going to ask Bablo, actually, the question I wanted to ask him was what role parents can play in shifting the consciousness of musicians. And the reason why is just because a lot of times, especially if you're looking at like hip hop music, popular hip hop music and whatnot today, a lot of these kids are basically taken away from their parents, and they're basically running with people in the streets and into crime and things like that, and they're trying to transition into music. So they have like a disconnect most times between the artists and their family, simply because a lot of them, you know, are raised in broken homes and broken families. And I was wondering what role parents could play to kind of groom their children to understand the history of these things, so that it would give them something to strive for above what they're hearing every day. And I was just wanted to get his opinion on that, because I just felt like I don't even call entertainment or any entertainment. I call it entercontainment, because that's exactly what you do every time. Like you said, when you turn on the TV, you know, you're entering the containment of white supremacy. So you're going into that world, and it's like tapping into the matrix of white supremacy every time you partake of entertainment in all of its forms, whether it's visual or music. And I just wanted to get his take on that, and it just gives you a lot of pause for thought. And when he talked about Schoolboy Q, and he said the lyrics from the song that he sang, and it made me think about the fact that we have like so many seriously compromised, mentally compromised people that are famous, making millions of dollars, and they're not even aware that they're making music that is completely self-destructive, and all they're thinking about is the dollar bill and trying to get out of whatever financial situation they might be in that drove them to become an artist in the first place. But just the whole idea that, I mean, none of us qualify for mental health, but just the idea that this kind of music, as black people, that is, this kind of music is being spread on such a mass scale. It's like, it's exactly what you said. It's poison. It's like, you know, partaking of poison every time you play these songs. And like you said, I did that. I have my own playlist. I listen to a lot of reggae, calypso, a lot of jazz. Actually, at work, if I'm not listening to the cows on my lunch break, I'm listening to jazz, or I'm listening to reggae or positive R&B. So I totally understand how music can shift your entire being into a different direction, as far as if you're in a mood that's really down, it can uplift you. And if you're listening to negative music, it'll take you further down the proverbial rabbit hole of self-destruction. So I think that this show is really important, even though Bablo didn't get to spend a lot of time on the show. It's interesting because I grew up listening to him and Imhotep Gary Bird on WLIB for quite a long time. And my parents lived for his show, for Bob Law's show, as well as the other black radio show hosts that were actually doing quite a bit of constructive work during my childhood. And we have to figure out a way. That's why I think this show is so important. We have to make a way to spend our money with the people that matter most, that are doing the most constructive work to help us fight the system. And that's why this show to me is probably one of the most important shows I've ever come across, and I will continue to support it. And thank you so much for taking my call, and I'll probably have something to say about other stuff later, but I just wanted to chime in with that. Thanks, guys.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He mentioned Abby Lincoln. Bob Law did, and I just want to, nothing but a man. Every time I hear a name, I know she had her own career and she was a great singer and did lots of stuff, but that's the first thing that comes to mind when I hear Abby Lincoln. Nothing but a man. Excellent. Ivan Dixon, folks should check that out. Very constructive film, reveals a lot about racism, white supremacy, the legend, Abby Lincoln, who spoke pretty frankly about racism, white supremacy, and how it was impacting her career as an artist, and, you know, what she was willing to do, what she was not willing to do, black self-respect, to compromise herself as a black female. But he did mention Abby Lincoln as well. Other folks who chimed in, if we have not heard from you, if you had anything you wanted to share, Maurice White, or what you heard from Bob Law, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be great.
Yes, sir. I'll definitely try to. You know, I'm in my 30s or whatever. So, you know, I did listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire as a kid, and I still do. And for me, it just always felt like the music just made me feel more human. Like, it made me feel like just more. I don't like to throw the word spiritual around too much, but it did. It just made me feel human. Like, it makes you. It did. It was very relaxing. It made you feel like you can think on a clear level instead of just focusing on just the day to day hustle and bustle, the day to day racism that everybody goes through. But it just made you feel better. It made you feel like you could. Be artistic, or you can be use your imagination, which is one of their songs, or something like that. But it just made you feel better as a human. But and I just feel now, I also came up around the time when, you know, NWA, stuff like that was coming out, and I'm just trying to, I just
oh, are you still with us, sir? Might have got disconnected. If you want to ring back in. Oh, are you still there? Did you hit your mute button, maybe?
Yes, I hit my mute button.
Sorry. Okay, gotcha.
But I wanted to ask Mr. Law, like, being, like, is there, I'm hoping there's a way, you know, that we can kind of turn this around, because we're being, of course, saturated with music that's pretty much programming us to worship money. Like, there's no type of other type of message, really. Worship money, just our basic, counterproductive behavior, just sex. It's all just talking about random sexual acts, money, violence, of course, just killing people. And I'm like, wow, for me, the Earth, Wind, and Fire kind of, I'm starting to make that transition. I'm getting to that age or that maturity level, just that, I guess, the consciousness or being less confused that I it's hard for me to really listen to the rap or the hip hop that I grew up listening to before. Like I can't listen to counterproductive stuff that just talks about the negative behaviors that we do. But I wanted to ask him how can we turn this around? I know he spoke on it a little bit, but it seems like the radio stations, things like Earth, Wind, and Fire is considered old. Like you listen to that old stuff, but I feel that music is timeless. Like it really has no real date to it. It's timeless to me, and it's like any of these music outlets you listen to, these radio stations now. Yeah, you have a couple of like old school stations or whatever, but most of them are just pumping out again this hip hop, this pop that's very negative. And I'm like, man, how can we turn this thing around to really inspire people to, you know, listen to more Earth, Wind, and Fire type of music? But I don't know. I really love the music, and it's just something I innately felt as a kid. Even, you know, five, six, seven years old, it just felt better to me. It felt good to me, even though I really enjoyed the hip hop. But it was something about the music that Earth, Wind, and Fire put out that made me feel a lot different. And again, made me feel human. It makes you feel like you couldn't listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire album or a song and go out there and do something unjust to somebody. It just felt like that. But, you know, that's my two cents. Thank you.
For sure. If other folks have commentary they want to get in as well, I can only say I know we have younger listeners as well. It would probably be constructive. Like, I'm just trying to have in mind some of the album covers that I've seen over the years. I used to DJ, so I've seen a lot of vinyl, seen a lot of CD covers and what have you. If you go and look at some of the album covers for Earth, Wind, and Fire, and then like compare that to album covers for a lot of popular black music over the last 10 years, wow, like it is an amazing contrast, just that alone. Like, you don't even have to listen to the music. Just look at the album covers for like Earth, Wind, and Fire, Head to the Sky, and Spirit, I Am. Look at that, and then look at stuff that has come out that's been pretty popular for the last 10 years, black music. Amazing difference just in the artwork alone before you even get into the actual sounds that, you know, are in those on those particular albums. The other thing, when I say consistently, generally talking about films, but the same would apply for music, that you should check out a person's body of work. It'll give you a better analysis for who this person was as a performer, as an artist, and just it'll give you a more comprehensive understanding of any individual work that you're looking at. I normally say that applying to films, but it would certainly apply to music as well. The body of work that Earth, Wind, and Fire and Maurice White specifically put out is, I mean, wow. There are probably very few artists who can compare in terms of the volume of work and the quality of work that they put out for decades. I learned more just in the past few days since his transition, but I was looking. Maurice White, like, produced other songs not even connected with Earth, Wind, and Fire that are like classics in and of themselves. I think a lot of black people are familiar with Denise Williams, her song Free. Maurice White produced that. Like, man, are you serious? Like, incredible talent, incredible. And that would be another example. Every time it's not explicitly I'm black and I'm proud, keep your head to the sky, but the same message, Denise Williams, Free. Incredible body of work, Maurice White. Other folks, if we haven't heard from you, if you had commentary you wanted to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I had a few things I wanted to say about Maurice White. You know, it was about a year and a half ago. I got on, like, a soul music kick. I grew up listening to hip-hop. And my mother hated my music, so therefore I hated her music. It was a response. So I heard these songs, but, yeah, that's my mother's music. And a year and a half ago, I got into, you named them earlier, Mayfield. And just the beats and the backgrounds and all of that. And, you know, I typed them into Pandora. And they played on the Earth, Wind, and Fire song, The Reasons. And I quickly put this station in, and I started downloading some of their music. And I was really intrigued me was the artwork and the album covers. Very comedic, very much like an X-Men. I was really impressed by them. And I wish I'm a little... I was born in 77, so I really don't remember them being, like, a group out when I was a kid. I always see them come out on, like, the Soul Train Awards. And
your line is breaking up a little bit. Your line is breaking up a little bit.
Yes, I would see them on, like, you know, tribute shows, the Soul Train Awards and things, and I would always... You know, whatever they played the song, it brought me back to a memory from my childhood, you know, with my mother, and it just was really good. And, you know, I had a few questions for him. One, I just wanted to know how he felt, you know, how did the artist feel from that generation making such great music, composing it, writing it, but not being paid the equivalent, you know, of being the creator of that music, having the people who are able to put the music out take the credit for creating it and take the royalties. And I also wanted to know, with the white pop stars now crossing over, because he mentioned R&B and soul music, with white pop artists crossing over into R&B. And now they have that white woman from England, Adele or Estelle, whatever. She's considered to be the most soulful singer in the world. And with the labels all merging together and Clear Channel and iHeart owning all the radio stations, all the major corporations like Amazon and Google and Apple controlling all the sales and streaming, where did he see black music going? Going forward, if he saw a bright future for it or not. And that was my two questions for him, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Hopefully we can get him back on the program. So, you know, if folks have questions, this will be archived, so we can just go back to this and maybe even just go right to questions to see what his responses are. Any of the folks that dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Bay Area caller, were you commenting or?
Let me take you up because I was listening in my car. One, let me push this button. Sorry, can you? Am I clear and not distorted and muffled and stuff?
You're pretty clear.
Okay, super. Because I'm driving illegally. I just wanted to. I was thinking. I was just listening to everyone, and I came up in like 71. That's my year. So with Earth, Wind, and Fire, maybe the teenagers, the people that were a bit older than me, were really into it. I had a different respect for Earth, Wind, and Fire because of my mom, and then it's just she was so particular with this Earth, Wind, and Fire, and she would just break it down, and I didn't know I didn't understand why I would have to go through that, but as I get older, I do now, but then she was just so extreme with it, and the Earth and the Wind and the Fire, and you listen to the lyrics, look at the album, and look at that. It's like, what are you talking about? But she was an artist, so she was looking at it differently, and then by me being a child, and if that kind of music wasn't as popular, like I think Earth, Wind, and Fire did After the Love Is Gone, if I'm not mistaken, and I remember that. So it's just certain tunes that I had to listen to because I was a musician's child, but I didn't, I remember it was something extreme about Earth, Wind & Fire. It was just like, those are serious. That's a serious album, you know. Don't just pick that up. It's serious. And so I wouldn't, I'd just go straight past it. But I do remember the vibe, the feel of the music. The rhythm was different. The tone, I don't know what tone they were using as far as tuning the music, but it was kind of like a, it was different. The energy was different. It's maybe like a Bob Marley tone. It was different versus the destructive tones that the music is tuned in now. So I do remember that. I do remember it was I do remember Earth, Wind & Fire being more conscious. It was always conscious and it was always serious. Well, my mama was serious. I don't know whether other people's parents, but I don't think their parents were musicians either. So it was just a little different for me. And then my mom was a little different because she was already on that level. So, and I do remember a caller stating something about the artist and how they maintained in that kind of atmosphere. And I remember my mom would always tell me, they're doing mind control, and it's mind control. They're trying to control your mind. And I didn't understand that when she was speaking because it was just so crazy. But now, as I'm an adult, I do understand why they changed and why they do it the way they do it to control the music and the mind. And that's all I wanted to state, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. Drive safely down in California. Drive safely. Absolutely. I was not born when Earth, Wind & Fire was doing a lot of their, I guess they were in there, what they call heyday and all that. I wasn't even born yet. So my hearing a lot of this is hearing older black people that I was around, them playing it. And then, as I say again, being a DJ, I did start to pretty aggressively check liner notes to see where people were getting their samples from and all of that. So I kind of retrograde in that manner, came to know about Earth, Wind & Fire and starting to listen to them and Roy Ayers and a lot of other just incredible black artists. But I can say, like, seeing Erykah Badu, like, that's closer to, I guess, be my generation. I've seen her play with a kalimba, a thumb piano, at live concerts, and I'm like, oh wow, that's so cool. And even at the Smithsonian, they had one, and I was going to buy one, and not realizing, like, oh wow, that's Earth, Wind & Fire too. Like, bringing the influence that they had is just it is mind-boggling. And I was out Saturday, so that was, I guess, like 2-3 days after he had passed away. I was in a store. This was not a black business, I did not buy anything, but I was in a store, and they were playing music, and they were playing Earth, Wind & Fire. I think they were playing September, but it was one of the songs that you'll hear at, like, weddings and that sort of thing. That's just really, really popular movies and that sort of thing that people would not connect. Like, oh, this has anything to do with uplifting black people and black self-respect. I strongly suspect that for a lot of these black artists, the same thing that you see with black artists and black people that work against racism, that it will be a strong effort to sanitize Earth, Wind & Fire so that you do not connect their music with black uplift and African spirituality, so that it'll just be, oh, this is just great party music, and yeah, let's play September and Shining Star. I suspect it will be a lot of that, and no, don't put any of the album covers up that have any of that pyramids and mumbo jumbo. Nah, don't show that. Just play the music. And yeah, they were great, great black musicians, and, you know, just leave it at that so that people don't. Same thing almost like I was saying last program, so that people have a very superficial connection to what this group was about and what they were attempting to communicate with their artistic product. I will stop there. Other folks, if we haven't heard from you, did you have a comment that you wanted to add? Saw other hands. Anybody that had a hand up that we haven't heard from? Do you have anything you want to make sure you got in related to what Bob Law shared or Earth, Wind & Fire, Maurice White? Assume maybe they had other things to comment on, or perhaps might not be in a area where they can speak. Quick, I guess, thought I would get in, and then if we have a final comment on that, we move to other topics. Quick thought that I will get in. Number one, this was a while ago. This was not recent. This was years back where Mr. Fuller, I heard him talking, and he was just talking about the music, and his prediction was that things are going to get dramatically worse in terms of anti-blackness and the lack of black mental health, black mental illness. He was saying it's going to get dramatically worse, and one of the things that he went to was the music. And he said that, you know, 50 years ago, you at least had, you know, some Earth, Wind, and Fire. You had the Supremes, Nina Simone. You had at least some nice music where it wasn't, you know, black people name calling each other and talking bad about black people and I'm going to kill this black person and end this and nigger that, nigger this, blah, blah, blah. You didn't have all of that. And he said that you really haven't even seen the effects of all of that because probably just about now, maybe this is the first generation or yeah, I'd say you're probably, this is probably about the first generation where that is a normal thing to grow up. And that's the regular music that's on all the time. I would still say this is probably the early stages, probably about 2020 when you'll have like a first generation of people where that is a normal thing, where it's typical and on a lot of mainstream outlets, not just something that people are listening to, but this is like everywhere and vastly promoted. Sorry for the interruption, but yeah, having that type of anti-black music that is vastly promoted and it's just, this is a normal thing. Weed smoke being blown in the camera and the profanity and I'm going to kill this black person and kill this nigger and blah, 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 and all of that. He's give it another 4 years where you've had a whole generation of people. That's what they've grown up listening to. That's just the typical thing that's in the speakers. Like, oh man, the impact that that has on behavior and conduct. And I would say it is planned. That's just another aspect of the toxicity of racism, white supremacy. And even as something as simple as the names, our caller in the Bay Area, I was thinking that's another thing. I think Bob Law talked about that when he was on the program last year, where you, back then, the Supremes, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the names that people are taking, or even if they're just going to use their name, Otis Redding and Nina Simone. Whereas now, it's Dr. Wilson would always mention Bow Wow and Snoop Dogg and Niggas with Attitudes and all the other stuff that has become, you know, very, very popular, even in terms of the names that artists have and the people that get promoted. It is astounding just the job that racist man, racist woman have conducted, and deliberately. There's a lot of content. We've talked about the importance, the power of music and how that's being controlled. We've done quite a few programs over the years, even going all the way back to when we first came on the air, when Professor Griff, we had him on a couple times, as well as many others. But it is astounding just to contrast and to look at the work of Maurice White. I guess, and the last thing I will add, and then if anybody else had a final comment on this subject matter, I had talked about this. This was before the cows even came back to the air in 2009. Bob Law said, racists, they know the power of sounds and vibration and how that can impact people, the effect that that has on your brain computer, the sounds that are being played, particularly music. In my view, they made another calculated move that I don't think gets as much attention. Another extremely calculated and devastating move attacking black people in the same period, 60s and 70s, to make sure, hey, we're totally done with this. We're not having any more I'm Black and I'm Proud. We're not going to have another generation of Nina Simones. We're not going to have another generation of Nat King Coles and Max Roach, Maurice White, Aretha Franklin. We're totally done with this. And that move being, we're taking instruments out of the school. If you talk to, man, lots of distractions today, but a concerted effort to say, we're not going to have this. We're taking musics out of the schools. If you talk to older black people, when I say older, like black people that are in their 60s or up, if you talk to them, they will talk about how common it was at that time to have black people that played musical instruments. It was just everybody was playing some sort of musical instrument. You would stumble on black bands all the time. Maybe they weren't, you know, successful in going out and doing gigs, but just in terms of you could play an instrument, no big deal, whether it's piano or drums, whatever, you could play an instrument. Taking that away, huge impact. Just for that's something right there that you can do that is constructive. That's something right there that you can do where you can make money, even if you don't, you know, have aspirations to, I'm going to, you know, make CDs and do this professionally. That's something where you can do where either you're teaching someone else, you could go and do, you know, small shows on the side. I mean, just a lot of different things that you can do with that. And just the value of being able to play an instrument, that in and of itself is hugely constructive. You're using another part of your brain. It's a different just vibration. It's a different way to connect with sound. And it's something that you're producing, as opposed to I have to listen to the radio to have music. I can just play something myself, or I can play with my other black friends. We can relate in a constructive manner. We can just sit down and play music together. That was a huge calculated move to remove the likelihood of having Maurice Whites and these type of folks that come through that have extraordinary talents that they will never be able to tap into, because we're just going to take that away. And I mean, there's scholarship on this being done deliberately. And that I think folks who have more knowledge, that's how hip hop came about, kind of people going and figuring out other ways to express themselves artistically. But huge move, and maybe even something that folks who are working with children and have some interest getting them connected with musical instruments extremely, because at least it's been my experience that a lot of younger black people don't think about musical instruments as being cool at all. Like, no, I don't play a saxophone or the drums or anything like that. They have no concept of, oh my gosh, like some of, you know, incredible black musicians, they don't even have a concept of that. I think like Kenny G was mentioned and Adele, like that's the type of thing that they think of, not the just astronomically, I would even say otherworldly black geniuses that have, you know, graced all of these musical instruments. Master move by Racist Woman, Racist Man to remove those instruments from the classrooms across the country where this happened. No coincidence, right after the 1960s. No coincidence at all, in my opinion. Any final comments on this subject matter? Anybody want to make sure they get in?
Yes, sir. That was exactly what I was emphasizing and trying to say about the deliberate cut of the arts. Musical bands and marching bands, when I was coming up, some of them would have over 100 members in the band. And there's all kinds of constructive things that takes place out of that, especially when a person is matched with something that's called a musical instrument. In order to master that, you have to have discipline. You have to be patient. When I was coming up, it wasn't unusual for kids to take piano lessons. My sister went to take piano lessons from a woman who was a close friend of the great Mary McLeod Bethune, who built the university on a trash pile that we know now today is called Bethune-Cookman University. It taught you patience. It just taught you the arts and also what it takes in order to master something. You have to be patient and disciplined and whatnot. And that branched over to other things in a person's life. I'm around. My offspring is 19 years old, and I'm around teenagers almost more than half of the year. I'm around teenagers, and now they have the technology to whereas not only they're pumping this negativity into their heads, they actually now it's a practice to plug the earphones into their ears, so it's going directly right into the brain. You know, this if Malcolm X is known now as looking ass nigger. That's what he's known as now, in one of these songs that I've heard, and I sit and listen to the lyric and I want to vomit when I go on a computer and look at and read the lyrics of some of the stuff that is being mass produced, And it has to be a processing weapon that's being used in the most sophisticated, diabolical manner, in my opinion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Folks have other comments they wanted to get in before we move on? Different subject? Anything else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to, I think Firefighter in Florida brought up some really salient points, and it made me think back because I'm 42. I was born in 1973, and I remember we didn't really have music classes, and the classes that we did get when I was in junior high school, the only instrument that they allowed us to play was the recorder. They had a band, but those people had their own separate classes from the classes in which they taught the use of the recorder. I totally sucked at doing at music class, but I also made hip-hop music. I got into that at about the age of 16 and started producing and all of that stuff, and I was actually very good. So I could actually produce music on the platform of hip-hop that I couldn't play in the classroom, which I found very fascinating. My son, you speaking about the importance of playing music and how it can affect the psyche of children, my son, he's now 20, and he started playing the trumpet. Weirdly enough, he's born the same day as Miles Davis, May 26th. He plays the trumpet, and he started playing at in the fourth grade. He plays till this very day. He has been a straight-A student his entire school career. He has a 4.0 in college right now. And he actually came home and told me that his teachers told him how important music is for activating the right brain and how that kind of helps the mind synthesize information on a much higher level. And it's a very powerful thing. And if anyone on the show, listening into the program tonight, is connected to African traditional religion, drums and music. Actually, drums, you have the talking drum in West Africa, which they use to actually communicate. So the same way we're speaking now, you can have a full conversation between two different groups of African people just using the drum. And in African traditional religion, the way that, especially like the Yoruba tradition and the Kemetic tradition, Akan, you name it, they use the drums to literally call the gods down. So when someone is possessed by a particular deity, whether it's Shango or Shun or Yamaya or any of the other African deities, essentially it is the drums and the music that they use to take you to that ecstatic state of trance. So the same thing, in my opinion, happens in reverse when you're listening to damaging music. And like I said before, it takes you down that proverbial rabbit hole of self-destruction, whereas the music that we created was meant to take you to higher planes of spiritual and mental consciousness, and actually it's great for your mental health. And you talked about Abby Lincoln earlier, and actually Bob Law talked about Sarah Vaughan. I just wanted to say, if any of you wanted to look it up on YouTube, they are two of Gil Noble's best episodes that I've seen on Like It Is. Was one where he interviewed Abby Lincoln, and I believe that's on YouTube, as well as the one that he interviewed Sarah Vaughan, and they went back to her hometown, and she had some of the most profound things to say on that program. So if you get the chance to look it up, you should definitely see it. It's really powerful stuff. And thank you very much, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Folks, anybody else on this topic? Things they want to make sure they get?
Quickly on the music. I got what the Roz was saying on the drum. You have these brothers who get on the train. They get on the train with the drums, with the African drums, and they just beat the drums. And, you know, sometimes I just close my eyes and zone out, and I feel like I'm in the jungle. You know, it really feels good. And, when I went to school, they didn't have musical instruments. And up until the fourth grade, they did have a music class, but it was a lady with a piano, and everyone had to sing. And then after the fourth grade, I went to Catholic school where they didn't have any musical instruments at all. That wasn't a part of the curriculum. And I just wanted to say, as for the hip-hop, you know, when hip-hop first started, I think it was a huge counter-racist movement. That's why it had to be put in check. But if you listen to hip-hop, especially from the golden era of hip-hop, a lot of the samples come from music like that Earth, Wind & Fire, others from that generation made. a lot of the samples. And, you know, it's just a testament of how good the music they made was. You know, it lived not only its lifetime, but someone else's lifetime. To, you know, I could be anywhere and I hear a song, I'm like, hey, that's such and such's beat. You know, whatever rapper used that beat, I would know. And, you know, that's a, you know, to me, a compliment to the creativity and the art that they put forth.
For sure. The caller, Victim, I heard you as well. If you could speak up again, your volume is very low. So as much volume as you can give us, sir.
Yes, sir. I just want to say myself, what I need, I do with my children. Sometimes you have to, you know, if you're riding in a car with them or whatever, but yeah, it's best that you definitely expose them to some of this type of music, something like Earth, Wind, and Fire, because believe it or not, you know, of course they're going to be inundated with the negative stuff all the time with, you know, being in school and radio stations or whatever, but they're going to come back around to it. I think that's what happened with myself too. You know, I was exposed to it briefly as a young child, and you know, I've come right back to it, and I appreciate it a lot more. So if you're going on a long trip, or your child or anything, is or any young person, it doesn't have to be your child, play some of this music. They're going to be, oh, this is old or something, but I think they're going to naturally, the music is so good that they're going to naturally they're going to like it, and they're going to feel it on some type of, even on a subconscious level. And they'll have once they mature, or once they become, you know, less confused, hopefully they all do that. They'll definitely come back to it and revisit it, and they'll see it in a different light.
For sure. We nab everybody. It's the other folks who dialed in with the hand up. Skit Lady, did you have commentary? Lady, you should be with us.
Thank you, Gus. Hello, everyone on the line. I actually did have a comment about Earth, Wind, and Fire. My children love them. They request that we hear their music every day. I have it in the home, in the car. I play that music because of the healing properties of the music, the frequency of the music. My son was considered to have ADHD, which I don't feel he does. I was given a questionnaire. I didn't even know what it was really about, and the doctor just simply diagnosed him. I didn't even voice any concerns, but I play this song because I find that it, their songs, because they're calming and the type of energy it gives my children is very motivating and calming. They, first thing in the morning, listen to Shining Star every day, and that helps them do their work with me being a home educator. But I really want to speak to how a lot of their music, the frequency level of their music is healing. The vibrations from the music can be healing. They can be, or they can actually be negative. So these are things that we don't know that we're hearing and feeling. And primarily Earth, Wind, and Fire's music is on their hurts, or frequency of their hurts is on the healing level. So that's just a part of music therapy with me reading and researching music therapy. Both of my children had music therapy for a speech delay, and so I thought it was a joke and a waste of time. So I began to read and study up on music therapy, and not just the artistic part of learning how to play music, but what it can do for the spirit and the soul. So if Earth, Wind, and Fire's music was able to do that, then you have to think that there is music that is out there that is counterproductive and will give the exact opposite effect. I noticed that there is a change with the music, but music that had a exact negative effect was that heavy metal, hard punk rock music. And if you flip through the radio stations, your FM radio station in your car, you will notice that that music is not heavily played anymore. And I think that is for a reason, because for the white audience, that was their primary music that they would listen to. And I think they scaled that back because of that reason. If the music is just very bad for you mentally, for your heart rate will speed up. If you're driving with it, you can, you know, have more collisions, more accidents. So it just really has a behavioral effect as well to it. So I think that that music was phased out for a little bit lesser music, such as the pop. You hear that now. If you tune into any radio stations, that's more geared toward white, a white audience. So I don't think that hip-hop will have can have a negative effect. If you allow it to, it can. It just depends on the frequency of the music. But those musics from Earth, Wind, and Fire, Natalie Cole, the jazz, it's proven. There's so much research on it that it feeds the soul, and it's definitely something that has been taken away from black children, children who are quote-unquote in poverty, so that they don't have that nourishment for the soul. And I think that anybody who has children should definitely play this music or music, similar music, because of just the positivity that it gives children. And it'll give you some positive, you know, you'll be pretty happy when you're in the house and you're cleaning with that too. So I'll mute my line.
For sure. Appreciate that. Caller in Michigan, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
I do. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
My apologies for getting my hand up so late, but I'm able to talk in a quiet space. And definitely wanted to chime in on the discussion. I have much appreciation for Earth, Wind, and Fire and the music. I heard one of the callers before mention how I know growing up, I was born in 75, and, you know, just a lot of the rap music was what I listened to when I was younger, but I came to appreciate a lot of the music from the 70s and a lot of the artists, and especially Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I find myself playing more and more of the music because it's just, I mean, because of the lyrics and how it just makes me feel. And out of my children, it's really interesting. I have an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old, and, you know, they're the ones who have the earplugs in and they want to listen to their music while I'm playing Earth, Wind, and Fire in the car or as we're driving about. And I have an 8-year-old, and he's the one that really, like, he loves Earth, Wind, and Fire. He loves Stevie Wonder. He loves Michael Jackson. And it's like, wow, you know, so he's the one that is like knowing. I'm like, wow, you know the words to the Earth, Wind, and Fire song. And it just really was interesting because, like, out of, you know, my three children, my youngest, my 8-year-old is the one that that, you know, rocks it out with me, so to speak. So it was just interesting just to see that dynamic. And then another thing with the schools, my two teenagers, they went to a school here in Michigan where it's right on the border of the Detroit city line. Like, I know a lot of people are familiar with the street 8 Mile because of the movie. Well, on, like, the other side, quote unquote, of 8 Mile is the suburbs. So there's a school that a lot of the students, the children from Detroit go to, that's like directly across the 8 Mile border. And one of the schools, you know, I took my children, I put them in, they have a marching band. That's like one of the few schools that's close to the Detroit border that has a marching band. And I noticed in the school, like, the majority of the white students in the high school are in the marching band. The sports programs and all the other programs aren't heavily funded. they're losing funding, but the marching band has so much funding. The community raises money. They have alumni raising money, and they are so committed to the marching band, but it's 90% white. Like the white students aren't in the sports anymore. They're not on the wrestling team. They're not doing a lot of the extracurricular activities, but they're in the marching band. And I noticed that's what's heavily funded. And my daughter joined the marching band and the color guard. And so she was touring and, you know, they're in competition. And so they had a state competition this past summer. So it was all the marching bands in the entire state of Michigan. Her school won first place, and I sat back and I watched all the schools that competed. These were schools from all over the state of Michigan. They all drove down to downtown Detroit to compete in the marching band competition. And when I looked at the majority of all the competing schools, they were all 90% white students that were in the marching band. So it's interesting because prior to my students going to the schools that's not in Detroit, they were in Cass Tech, and they had a great band, but it didn't qualify for, you know, to compete in this statewide marching band. I mean, the music that they played was different, but in my opinion, it was a great band, but they just never qualified and won and made it to the level where they were able to compete in like the all-state championship. So like, you know, it was mentioned before, that is something that's being taken away from black children. And I just found it kind of fascinating, you know, being a part of that since my daughter is in the marching band now. So that's what I wanted to share. And thanks for taking my call.
Appreciate that. Wow. That is astounding. I mean, that used to be synonymous, marching bands and having, you know, incredible black musicians out being in the marching band. That, you know, used to be a staple, I think, for decades. And white people even changing that, too. The caller at 1902, did you have commentary you wanted to add as well? Last four digits, 1902. Did you have a commentary you wanted to add, or are you just listening?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hello, everybody. The first time calling. I think I emailed you about participation a couple of weeks ago. I've been on this first time on the cows. I've been listening to this for about a year now, and it's wonderful. And it was ironic that I call in on my first time when you had Mr. Law on. I've heard him on the Carl Nelson show, and that's how I even got to this, made this connection with this show, was through Carl Nelson. And I've been listening to Carl Nelson for the last couple of years. I used to listen to Joe Madison, Black Eagle. Then they took him off the WOL, the Carl Nelson, and, you know, people would call in, and it was the only conscious black talk that was up in the morning. One morning person, I'm in the fifth worst place for African American in the United States, in Peoria, Illinois, and I work at a place that's basically like the Steelers for Pittsburgh, the Steel corporations. You know, they, when they left, the Steel, you know, Pittsburgh and Steelers, you know, kind of, that's how Caterpillar is for Peoria. That's where I work. But, yeah, if it wasn't for Carl Nelson and Black Talk Radio, I don't know where I would, I'd go crazy, you know. And, like I said, there's a couple of things I just wanted to talk about, just to make me, you know, I'm sorry to rambling. I think earlier today you were talking about, I was reading earlier in New York Times about Beyonce. You were talking about it. I think day before yesterday on the Monday podcast, or the one, oh, actually the Sunday one, which is great to hear her voice again. I don't even want to talk about her. I'll just break up. But yeah, now they're having a rally in front of the NFL headquarters tomorrow. Supposed to be a rally against racism on halftime. Halftime show. Did you hear anything about that?
This is my first hearing of it. I had heard about the people that were upset about Beyonce's performance, but I didn't know they were having a rally tomorrow.
Oh, they are having a rally. And I just said, oh, God, I got to call in, you know. And, that was crazy. I mean, I know it's, you know, entertainment, but it was just funny how they run. They run. If you look like you have any black self-respect, they will huddle up, you know. And just like Mr. Fuller said, I listen to Carl Nelson's show. People will call in, talk crazy, get off subject, and a woman would call in, and she would set it straight. Let's get back to the subject at hand. We're talking about A. We're all the way over to X, you know. And this woman would keep coming on, and Carl would go up. Everybody, you know, she had an open line. And it was so warming to hear that. So I did research, where, you know, and then her talk about Mr. Fuller, who was talking about this? And then, you know, that's where I come in with the cows. So it is very constructive. I feel better by, you know, calling in. Another thing about the radio, I listen to Joe Madison every morning. Why? Because Carl Nelson is now on, you know, I think one of your callers a couple weeks ago talked to you about it. They moved Carl back to 4 o'clock and put buffoonery on in the morning. I'm shucking and jiving. I just don't like that. I mean, excuse my language. I just don't like it. But they put those three people on, and I refuse to listen. So I've got to go to SiriusXM and talk, you know, and listen to Joe. And he's an older black male, and he's NAACP, and he's done this and done that. He really talks it up. And he's, you know, don't get me wrong, he is constructive, and he got ballot points. But it's one thing about older, you know, black males I've noticed is that I'm 37, so I'm with the old school. I like the lines of Mr. Fuller, Dr. Welding, how they relay information, how they lay it down without, you know, kind of talking down to you. I call it the Cosby talk, you know, when they talk down to you. And it's good talk, you know, real talk, but let's not do it and walk off. You really can't say anything to them because what? Cosby got dough. I mean, he got money. So he's always talked down to black folks and rubbed me the wrong way. And Joe Madison does that. And there's only black talk in the morning that, you know, I listen to down in Atlanta. There's some guys down there, but they talk real talk, you know. But they pump a lot of hope and vote. Hope and vote. Vote Hillary, Bernie, Billy. You know, and it's just like, you know, and they skim around white supremacy. They skim around racism. They just skate around it. And they might mention Black History Month. They'll throw some up, and they'll go, you know, bang. You know, but they'll jump right off of it. And I understand. It's serious, Sam. I understand. You know, so they'll lose their position. So this is I know you don't like the word like or love, but this is a show that this is something that I need. It's therapeutic, almost like that early Sunday morning haircut, like, or Saturday morning haircut. Like, this is very therapeutic. You know, so. Sorry for rambling on, and I'll meet my line.
Right on. First time caller. Good to hear from you. That is something I think is important, and I know it's everybody, Gusty Renegade's name at the top of the list, and making sure that we, and in my view, it's black self-respect. That's one of the principal ways to exercise and demonstrate black self-respect is in the way that we talk to other black people, victims of racism, in not talking down to people, I think this is something that's come up before in terms of where people get information about, you know, racism, white supremacy, and how it works, or just information about anything. It could be financial information or information about musical instruments, and a tendency to sometimes talk down to other black people and belittle them if they, you know, are not aware, if they're not informed, if they're missing, you know, some pertinent information that you have. And I think Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, she was a great example of just being very gentle, very kind, very patient, and how she dealt with other victims of racism. I definitely think that that's something that we should all try to the best of our ability to improve upon. And I think it's beneficial to counter racism because I think it's been my experience. People are generally much more receptive. Just talking about white supremacy is already toxic. The more that you can be patient, not cursing, not name calling, that can be very, very helpful in making or in assisting people be receptive to what you have to say so that they don't become contentious and feel like they need to defend themselves, that they're being belittled in some way, that they have to kind of protect their intellectual integrity. I've just found that that's very, because there's a lot of that anyway. So the best or whatever you can do to mitigate that is extremely helpful. I am getting some background noise. So people, if you know you're in a loud environment, if you know you have speaker, definitely no speakerphone, but if you could just watch that, and I'll make sure everybody's line is open so you can participate. I think we nabbed everybody who had commentary on this subject matter in terms of Maurice White and Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, Gus, could I say one more thing? I apologize. One more thing. We were talking about music earlier, and I'm, you know, in 79, so I grew up in the 80s. So hip-hop is, you know, and hip-hop is can take several different ways, and you can take that word and flip it eight different ways. But, you know, I listen to, I grew up on the Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang got me through high school. Yeah, of course, they had Reckless Talk and some of their talk, but it was knowledge. It was things that made you think about, hey, you know, there was conscious rap. It was the only conscious rap out there. And a lot of my guys here that I even associate with now, with not many, we all, you know, we have insurance on our cars, you know, we have a car, have a job. We all listen to that type of hip hop. And it's, you know, and I know, and there's a following in Seattle, but it was hard here in the middle of Illinois. And being in the Midwest, to me, I've always said to people, you know, at least down south, the racism is in your face. They'll tell you, hey, keep moving. You know what I mean? Like, up here, they would tell you, hey, come in, but then talk behind your back, you know, and stop you from, you know, advancing and, you know, befriend you and, you know, stop you from advancing later on. So it's a deceitful racism up here, which is the hidden, is the most worst. I mean, racism is racism, but, you know, like I said, it's just with the music, I like digging through crap to find gems. You know what I mean? Like, and that part of it, you know, the conscious rap community is far and in between, but they got some out there. Tommy and Khalid just dropped a new one, not too long ago. I like that one. I just wanted to say that, you know, music made me, made my brain move like this. It made me think in this way. And it had a lot to do with my high school years of listening to that type of hip hop. And even the hip hop in the late 80s and 90s. So, I'm sorry, I moved to my line.
Right on. I definitely wouldn't say Wu-Tang Clan was the only constructive or, quote, I won't even use the term, but constructive folks that were talking.
Not at all. I'm sorry. Not at all. Not at all. I'm not saying that at all. There's a lot out there, but that was the most mainstream at the time that was up front. Sorry.
Okay. Anywho, it was no coincidence I've said that consistently. The program that we did on Monday with racist suspects Ned and Constance Sublett, the American Slave Coast. It was such a massive book. I could have probably spent 3 hours just going through all the material that they had in the book. I've said this consistently. You have consistently, racists will write very informative books on racism where it'll have a lot of good information. I have seen that happen. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not racist. It doesn't mean even that if you go to talk to them about the book that they will be forthcoming and honest. But that being said, in that book, they have a passage that's talking about different revolts that took place all throughout the 17th, 18th, 19th century, where black people even killing other white people. One of the rebellions that they talk about, the Stoner Rebellion, which was in South Carolina in the 1700s. And they get a little bit after that, and they're talking about some of the things where white people refined their code to make sure that this was not continuing to happen, and how white people responded to this event, right in line with today's subject. The Sublets, they write, the mention of drums and singing ties the Stono Rebellion in with later rebellions, as well as with Congo military and spiritual influence. In Saint Domingue, which is now what we would call Haiti, and I guess Dominican Republic, since it's all one island, and Cuba, African drums were a means of military communication, as the British well understood. Since 1699, the law in Barbados had stipulated that whatsoever master and company shall suffer his Negro or slave at any time to beat drums, blow horns, or use any other loud instruments, or shall not cause his Negro houses once a week to be searched, and if any such things be there found to be burnt, he shall forfeit 40 sterling. Right in line with today, where this would seem to substantiate many of the things that have been shared, what Bob Law was talking about in terms of them understanding the immense power of black music. And I even think it should be underlined, boldface print, that black music was tied to military and spiritual practice. Anywho. Some of the other things that came up that I definitely wanted to make sure I touched on. If anyone was interested in reading Philip K. Dick, because that did come up, Philip K. Dick is a suspected racist. He wrote the book Man in the High Castle. There's a television series that's now out based on this book. It's about it's sci-fi. If the Nazis had won World War II, how the world would function under Nazi rule. I'm going to read the book. If other folks are interested, let me know. This probably wouldn't be an on-the-program read, although I guess it could be, but I guess it could be. I'll have to think about that for a second. I'm just going to read it, but it's not that long. I guess we could read it on the program. But I know Dr. Welsing, she wanted to read this book. This was one of the last times that I spoke with her in December of 2015. And like I said, I gave her the author, and she was very curious to get more information about this book and the series. She mentioned it in her final lecture at the Welsing Institute. So I know she would want us to read and study this book, maybe even watch the television series. I probably would be a lot more motivated to watch the TV series once I've read the book. So I'm going to read it. I'll just have to think, because we're almost at the end of The Half Has Never Been Told. I think we have maybe 2-3 sessions left. So we might do that for the book club. If not, I'm going to read it. But if anybody wants to make that kind of a private read, we can comment online, kind of like we did for the book that we did 5 days at Memorial about Hurricane Katrina at Memorial Hospital. Let me know. I'd definitely be game to do that off the air. We can take notes, compare, all that good stuff. If we have readers out there, it's not that long. It's fiction, so it's not like it would be a deep, you know, bogged down history with lots of footnotes and all that. It's a novel. It's fiction, so it's not a tough read. And it's not super long. I think it's like 400. I don't think that's a super long book, 400 pages. That's something that we could probably read pretty easily within 2 weeks, leisurely. We could read that very, very easily within 2 weeks, not on the air. The Akai Gurley trial, unless something big happened since we went live, I think they the jury is still deliberating as to whether or not Peter Liang, the non-white male, so-called Asian male, whether he will be convicted for the shooting death of Akai Gurley at the end of 2014. That's something we'll definitely be talking about this weekend on the compensatory call, but I would encourage folks to keep an eye on that whenever the deliberations are concluded. I saw today, I think it was one of the first things that I saw when I woke up this morning, they are doing a third installment of The Purge. We, Pam and I, have talked about this film, Trojan Horse, her blog, RacismWS.com, RacismWS.com. She wrote about this way back when the first one came out in 2013. I did a YouTube video on this. We've talked about this film franchise for, and even that for a film, the first film came out in 2013. It hasn't even been 3 years, and they already have the trailer out for the third film in this installment. I'm not, you don't have to watch the film. The short of it is basically, it's 20, I think The Purge is originally set, it's like the year 2020 or 2022, not too far in the near future. And something in 2016, they decide that they need to have a day where they authorize any crimes, including murder. So anybody, if you want to go out, kill as many people as you want, you have 24 hours to do so. And they call this day The Purge. And this is supposed to be great. We get rid of unnecessary people, munchers, moochers, people that don't contribute anything. We could just get rid of them. We can thin out our ranks a little bit, a little depopulation. That will be great, and it'll make our system work better. We'll have a higher quality of life if we get rid of some of these folks. That's the basic premise of the film. For whatever reason, this starts in the year 2016. Pam and I both noted that because that would be the final year in the President Obama's time at the White House. That, I think, is very significant. The first film, it is a black male. That's the character that they focused on, who is being hunted literally by a gang of white terrorists. And a white child, I would submit an effeminate white child. He's a male, a young white male, but he looks, he has a lot of what I consider feminine features, feminine qualities about his character. Anyway, he allows this black male to come in their house, to come in their residence. He provides him safety. And so the white terrorists come to this white home and are like, you're going to give us this nigger, or we're going to come, we're going to break into your house, we're going to kill you, and we're going to kill him. And that's the plot of the first film. Are you going to hand over this nigger for us to kill him or not? And it goes from there. The second one also is heavily focused on, it's a black female, it's a black female mom and her daughter who it's primarily focused on, and them being, same thing, them being hunted, a white or an individual who could be white, maybe not. He comes in to rape them. A different set of white people come in and they kill the rapist, and then they take them. They're going to kill them. I mean, it's just total pathology, white pathology, and this bloodlust, anything that's promoting violence and killing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The third one, I don't even know what it's supposed to be about, but it's supposed to come out sometime later this year. I think that is hugely important. It is a part of the zeitgeist of the time. I would connect that directly with everything that we're seeing right now in terms of Donald Trump, them going to rally tomorrow in the spirit of hating Beyonce and saying that she's a racist from the report that I saw just briefly while we were on the air. But I would say that is all a part of it. These snuff flicks, every other week you got another video of a black person that's been shot down, gunned down. This promotion of violence, and particularly violence that is focused on black people. I would submit that is, you can connect all of that with these more and more films and products that is promoting Nazi paraphernalia, where you end up with these incidents like what happened in Albany, where these black females are attacked on the bus by these group of random whites. We just have more and more of these type of incidents that this film is a part of that energy. It is a part of that vibration and encouraging this sort of violent behavior. But that is definitely something I saw today that I thought was important. Also, it was a report, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Victim of Racism. We did his book in the book study session the end of last year. I posted an article that he wrote where he was criticizing, and I think any white person should be criticized under the system of white supremacy, but he was criticizing Bernie Sanders, racist suspect, for his stance in opposition to reparations. Mr. Coates was on Democracy Now!, my BFF, Amy Goodman. He was on her program earlier today, and he said that he is supporting Bernie Sanders. He's going to vote for him in spite of his criticisms. I did think that that was important because I think there were some people who were not pleased with Mr. Coates' stance on Bernie Sanders and saying that, hey, this guy not supporting reparations, this sounds like a typical racist move from a white man. There were some people that were not pleased about that. In addition, Mr. Coates also wrote a piece where he was criticizing Hillary Clinton and some of her stances on racism. I thought that was significant as well. But he was on Democracy Now! Earlier today, and he said that he was going to vote for Bernie Sanders. Also, I guess the last thing that I would get in, there was... Man, I think I posted on Facebook. I was in Starbucks on Monday, and it was a white woman. She was seated next to me, and she was talking to another white man, and she was talking about the Super Bowl, and she was laughing. Ha, ha, ha. That Cam Newton, he's uppity, uppity. Those were her exact words. He likes to be uppity, uppity. And he got knocked down to size, and she was so happy about this, and they were just talking, and ha, 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 just glorying. It reminded me of the concept we talked of before, Schadenfreude. Where whites, they take pleasure in black suffering. I don't think we understand that at all, and I don't think the term white privilege captures that essence at all, which is a huge aspect of racism, white supremacy. Whites enjoy the misery of black people. But beyond that, so that was number one. I was leaving Starbucks, and I bumped into, it was a black female. I've seen her before. I think I've even talked about her before. Because she's just chatty, chatty, chatty. She's talking all the time, and frequently I'm busy. I'm trying to do things to prepare for the program and just have other things. I'm not sitting with the intent of just running off and chatting. That's not why, you know, I'm sitting at the coffee shop. I'm trying to get work done. But anyway, and she will be talking about things that I don't deem to be constructive. It's not like she's coming to talk about racism or other constructive information. A lot of times it will drift to, hey, let's go to church. And, you know, Christians, it's just like, come on, man, you're just need my time and energy. I bump into her and I'm thinking that's where the conversation is going to go. She throws me for a total 180. She says she's upset. I've never seen her upset before. She's very upset. And she's saying, these people think that they could just come in here and mess you over because you're a black person. And I'm like, you don't say. Really? Who are you talking about? And she says, these white people just, they come in. That's all they do is just put enslave people. That's all they know how to do is just come in and mistreat people and think if you're black, you're not going to get over it. And I'm not going to tolerate it. I'm going to stand up and you think you're going to mistreat me just because I'm a black person. And I'm like, wow, I have never seen this before. Like, what happened to you? And she's talking, apparently, some nasty workplace racism where whites on the job were mistreating her. Surprise. And she's upset about this, and she's talking about her strategy, how she's going to deal with this. And she was so upset, and she said, you know, I used to think that you were crazy, but now I realize that you are a little bit smarter than I thought. I cracked up laughing. I said, well, many people think I'm crazy. You're not alone in that. That's no big deal. But she went on, and she, the whole time, she just talked about racism and talked about racism. And she was so angry with these white people. And it got where she wasn't even talking about just like a specific white person. It was white people in general that she was upset with. And I said, wow, that was good for me to get that, because I think frequently we can become impatient and frustrated with other victims, other black people who maybe don't understand or maybe don't think that racism is a big deal. They don't understand what it means to be white. They don't want to talk about racism, may even chastise you for bringing up racism. It can be difficult to be patient with them and to hope that, you know, maybe that they get a better grasp of, you know, this is a monumental problem that we should all be concerned about. But I definitely, what I have concluded, if racism, white supremacy exists, and I've concluded it certainly does, and to the magnitude that I say it exists, where this is the dominant force on the planet, bar none, infecting everything, it is going to reveal itself. And many of these people who are confused, where they're not just in denial or lying to themselves, many of these people who are earnestly confused and just don't grasp that, they are going to realize this at some point, many of them. And maybe they won't get it from you. Maybe you don't have the words that will connect so that they grasp it. But something is going to happen where many of these folks are going to be confronted with, yes, white people are the problem. I should be thinking about this. I should be trying to do something about this problem because this is impacting all black people, all non-white people on the planet. But I did think that that was extremely important. That's something I say all the time. A lot of times you could just be patient. For all the victims of racism, all the non-white people who say that they are not victims of racism, just be patient. They will come around. They will have their incident where they realize what is indeed happening on this planet that is dominated, saturated, contaminated with white supremacy. Folks have anything else they wanted to bring up before we conclude? Any other topics that they thought were significant?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Thomas Smith in New York again. I had a couple of observations that I made. First one is about Akai Gurley. Today, the cop's lawyer asked for a mistrial, and it was denied by the judge. The jury requested to see the gun again, and I mentioned this on the other show. I knew the gun would be an issue because when they presented it into evidence, 10 of the 12 juries, without being advised to at all, decided they were going to pull the trigger, and they asked to see the gun again tonight during their deliberations. And that trigger could be loosened. You know, that apparatus on the gun could be manipulated. When I grew up, they called it an ear trigger. So they can say that gun was malfunctioned now, and that's what happened. So just watch out for that. You know, I think counter-racist, being a counter-racist is like a science. You know, you got to make observations and comparisons. You know, it's very important. You know, watching the campaigns, in particular, Mr. Donald Trump's, not for his speeches or, you know, his own commentary, but I watch it for the crowds that attend his events and to hear what they have to say. And C-SPAN has been playing a lot of the events that the candidates have been holding, and I've been able to catch quite a few of Trump's. And, you know, they all are saying from all the places, you know, he's saying what we can't say or he's saying what we want to say, you know, and they use very colorful commentary, usually followed after they say, you know, I'm going to be honest or I shouldn't be saying this. You know, and it's usually about Obama, Mexicans, or Islamic jihadist terrorists. And they've said things in particular about Obama, that he's a black supremacist. He's only looking out for black people. He's funding Black Lives Matter with our tax dollars, you know, and they're terrorists. And I've heard him give speeches now in Iowa, New Hampshire, Arkansas, and South Carolina, just to hear what the crowd had to say entering the event and leaving. And it's been quite, you know, entertaining, counter-racist observation for sure. And I don't think he's the most dangerous candidate for black people. I think Rubio and Cruz, especially Cruz because he's passive for white, are way more dangerous than Trump is. But, you know, just make that observation. Another observation I made, and I watched the O.J. movie just to see how they would portray him, guilty or not guilty. And I saw enough, I think, now from the little bit I saw that I'm not going to be tracking it anymore. I already see where they're going with it. Now, to stray away from the movie, because that was just, you know, no one can say if any of that's true. This trial was such a pivotal moment in history for racial, from a racial perspective. I wish I was as aware as I am now then. But looking back and remembering this trial, you know, I said it before on the show, first time they used the N-word, that's the first time it was ever used in the media, the race card, and as well as introducing that DNA evidence into the mainstream. Gus, do you remember this trial? I know during Katrina you were in Hawaii. This was a big event too. Were you? Do you remember? You know, this trial in particular?
Oh man, I was a child when that happened. I mean, I wasn't like in the crib, but I was a child when this happened. Like,
I think I was 18 or 19, and I remember watching this every day. It was on every channel, and from the callers, the people who remember the trial, just say yes if y'all thought he was guilty after the trial was over. Okay, we got one yes. Okay. What I remember from this trial, and I'm not sure if this movie, I'm not going to keep watching it, but I'm not sure if they're going to focus on this. But I remember seeing a fence in particular where there were spots of blood that they said was OJ's. It was collected by the cops who found the glove, trespassing on his property with no warrant. And the same cops also collected blood from him earlier and lost the valve mysteriously. And then OJ's lawyer, Barry Sheck, showed the same fence the night of the crime and the 3 days after, and it had no blood where they said the blood was that they collected. So how did that blood get there? You know, police were walking around the crime scene with no covered shoes, rubber glove, media had access to certain parts of the crime scene. So I remember thinking, and I think that over the years, white supremacists have done a real great job of making everyone think, you know, he was just flat out guilty. It really looked like he was set up, if I remember. That's all I'm going to say on that. One more thing from Bob Love. He mentioned Michael Jordan, and I read an article. Michael Jordan made $100 million last year from his Nike contract, which sounds like a lot of money. But Nike made about $3.5 billion selling Jordan brand clothes and Jumpman sneakers with the Jordan logo. So that's less than 10% he's making off of those clothes and sneakers that we're spending $200-$300 on as black people. And when I grew up, people were getting killed for. And my last observation, also on music, unrelated to what we were talking about before, I was ironing my kid's uniform, listening to Pandora, and I had it on Public Enemy Station. And white rap group Third Base came on with their song called The Gas Face. You know, it took me back to the episode that you did with MC Search, the Nas Royalty Extorter. And, you know, he was one of the few people that started the show off white, but later on he wasn't white, he was a Jew. Yeah, exactly. And I'm listening to the lyrics, and I'm singing them because I remember the songs. And like I say, when this came out, I wasn't codified at all. I was a little kid. And, you know, black cats are bad luck, bad guys wear black, must have been a white guy that started all that. And I'm thinking, man, the show we just did last week, we talked about Macklemore with his white privilege song. And they were doing this way before him. You know, this was way in the early 90s when they came out. And I just think Macklemore is just doing it a little bit more refined. But that's nothing new. And I'll mute my line.
Classic. Yes, lady, we can hear you. If you could speak up, that would be great. More volume.
Okay. Thank you, Gus. So I did want to make one last comment regarding the music. Just some things that I heard online that reminded me of Mr. Fuller and as well as Dr. Francis Cress Wellesley. So just thinking about the music, and I was listening. I actually think it was the cows I called in, and how I asked the question about this, and she discussed the sensory overload. I think me and my daughter may have talked and called in that night. So she was saying how these things are sensory overload, about how loud the music is, and talking on this program just reminded me of that, of how we are feeding our senses with the music. And then remembering hearing on another program Mr. Fuller talk about entertainment and having your entertainment be constructive, blending your entertainment with something constructive, you know. We can dance, we can listen to music, but what is your music telling you to do? Almost the same way how he says, you know, what does your religion tell you to do? How does your religion tell you to treat me? So that, those things just came into mind on how we use entertainment and making sure that what type of entertainment you indulge in, it just does something for your black self-respect, that it's keeping you in the mindset of having and exuding that black self-respect. So that was all I wanted to say on that and the music. I listened to the author and his wife call in. I didn't put myself in queue, but very constructive program, and I do appreciate that, Gus. Thank you for that. Those two authors who came on and discussed their book. I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I was going to say, I think I hit my mute when Thomas Smith in New York asked the question about OJ. I didn't actually care if he was guilty or not. I was just so happy that the system worked in favor of a black person, even though I knew, you know, he really didn't want to be associated with black people until he got caught up on this murder charge. But it was just the whole idea that finally one of us got through the crack of white supremacy to say, okay, even if I did it, I'm still walking. And that was my whole thing at that particular time. I'm sure I was one of many people in that situation. Also, when you told the story about the female that you had the discussion about, it actually reminded me of something I bring up on workplace racism, if you remind me. But a coworker came up to me today, and we had talked earlier about white people. And I basically talked to him about the system of white supremacy, and he understood. And we just had like an exchange about it. And I said, you know, they work in concert, you know, and I just said the Voltron effect, and he started cracking up. He said, yo, you're not kidding. And today, this was months ago, and today he came to me, and they just let somebody go, and he brought up, and it was a black female, and he brought up how they did her. And then the last time on workplace racism, I told you about how they got rid of another coworker of ours that did really exemplary work. And he's actually good friends with that female, and he brought her up today as well. So it was just funny that you discussed this conversation, even though the context was different since the lady said she thought you were crazy, and now she's starting to come around to that understanding. It was just that him and I had a previous conversation, and then he said, wow, what you said was correct when you were talking about, you know, the system and how they function. And then he gave me his reason using these two black females that they recently let go as an example of that. And when you talked about music and spirituality, it actually made me think because my family's from Trinidad and Tobago, and the steel pan is the youngest instrument created in the 20th century. And the reason for that was because of the subjugation of African people on those two islands, and they did not want them playing the drum whatsoever. You could actually get killed or hung for actually playing the drum in Trinidad, which is what pushed them to innovate by creating the steel drum using the empty oil drums. And there's a great documentary on Afropop. It just came out like maybe 2 weeks ago, and discusses in very intricate detail the history of the steel pan and the oppression that came with its development as an instrument, how it was originally associated with gang activity. A couple of my relatives actually played in steel bands, so I would hear these old stories about them having fights with cutlasses and things like that, and how it graduated from that to become now the national instrument of the country of Trinidad and Tobago, Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. And I just, when you brought that up, it just kind of made me think about that. And I think that was it. Yeah, that was it. That's all I wanted to contribute. Thank you very much, Gus. I appreciate it.
The more you know about racism, man, you will see how it impacts everything worldwide, directly, indirectly. Or you can take the inverse. The more that you find out, just more that you learn, the more that you will see how racism has impacted everything. Really quick, I will get in. I was a child when the O.J. Simpson thing happened. Again, I wasn't a baby when it happened, but, you know, I was not old enough to really be taking it seriously. The aspect that I became most emotional about with the whole O.J. Simpson trial was it interrupting the finals. Like, I was, like, really, really into basketball when I was a child. And, I mean, I was furious. Like, forget guilty, innocent. Like, they interrupted the finals. But I was livid, like, for days about
that. And Gus, they interrupted the finals between the Knicks versus the Rockets, like, two super huge markets. Tell me, like, that was just really huge, just to show him riding down the highway. I remember that.
Yep.
Livid. In fact, I know they did a documentary on the Rockets, and that came up in the Rockets documentary I think Kenny Smith and some of the other people that were on that Rockets team, they said that during, I think that was game five of the finals. This is 94, I think. Yeah, 94. So they said that while all this was happening, one of the timeouts, they had, I guess, monitors. This game was in Madison Square Garden in New York. And they said that they could see this on the monitors. And they were like, what? They're chasing O.J. Simpson. And they went down the bench. And they were, oh, my God. I cannot. That was what I was most upset about with all this. But I didn't have an opinion because I wasn't paying attention to it. I didn't have an opinion. Guilt, innocent. I wasn't happy. I wasn't upset. It was just, I hope they don't interrupt any more basketball games about this O.J. Simpson fella and moving forward. But I did not, even as I became older, I still didn't have an opinion on it. It wasn't something that I went back to look at, even though, I mean, this is amazing. Like, I wish I had been either more informed or older when this happened, so I would have been paying attention to it. But I remember, I think it was the 10-year anniversary, and I was in California, and white people were talking about it. On the job, no less, white people were talking about this. And I was on my break. I was not participating in their conversation. I didn't know them, but I wasn't in the conversation. I was doing my own thing. And they were talking about this, and yeah, he did this 10 years now. He did it. I can't believe he got off. Blah, 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 blah. Say, Gus, what do you think about the O.J. Simpson trial? And I said, I'm telling the truth, I never had an opinion on this. I was really upset that they interrupted the game. But other than that, I didn't care either way. I wasn't really vested in O.J. Simpson. I didn't really know who he was other than from commercials and some of the movies he was in. But I didn't really know who he was as a football player and all that other stuff. I wasn't happy. I wasn't upset. I said, but given my knowledge of this country and black people that have been accused of a crime against white people, I will say it is astounding. If he did this and he got off, that has to be like the first time in the history of ever that a black person committed this total crime against white people and was exonerated. And so the white people looking at me like, what? Right on cue. As soon as I like finish this statement, a black guy comes in and he hears the conversation and they're like, And he says, that's interesting. There was a argument. I guess he was some white people were out someplace at a club or some establishment. He said these white man, white woman, I guess they were a couple. They got into an argument. It became physical. The white guy's putting his hands on this white woman. Black guy's there. He intervenes. He's trying to step in to play peacemaker, like, hey, let's calm down. Let's, not be physical. And in stepping in between them, he, I guess, puts his hands up to kind of separate them, and he ends up pushing the white woman in the face. The police come. The police get there. They interview everybody, blah, blah, blah. They end up taking the black guy to jail and saying that you assaulted this white woman. You struck her in the face. We're taking you to jail. And that's the whole story. That's what he asked the conversation. I look at them and I said, that's the context that I would come from. I don't think I used the word context, but I said, that makes my point. I have seen no historical evidence where black people are able to harm white people and they're able to get away with it. That is astounding. If he did do it, astounding moment in history. And that was the end of the conversation.
Can I expound on it?
Yes, sir.
On the O.J. Simpson trial?
Yes, sir.
Yes. In my opinion, if you are a certain age, Renthal James Simpson was some sort of an icon, quote unquote, to non-white black people, because in and around the 60s and the 70s, it still was a very low content, positive or negative, of non-white black people being on television. And, of course, it's going to be, for the most part, in sports. and also to, let's say, black females, he was considered to be handsome. To black males, other than his proudness as a quote-unquote superstar athlete, he was cool. You know, even with the name OJ, he was nicknamed the Juice. So all of that came into that trial, and the content of in the magnitude of racism, white supremacy, in my opinion, is always high amongst non-white black people, even if they're conscious or unconscious. It still is there. Mr. Cochran was very good on his means of defending O.J. Simpson, but I think what I think Mr. Fuller said about the trial, that what actually was the tipping scale was the white attorney that was representing O.J. got in a one-on-one with the racist enforcement official. And because I remember Mr. Fuller stating that a lawyer, when he or she asks you a question, they already know the answer. It's waiting for you to either tell the truth or lie. And the white enforcement official openly lied about his using the word nigger, and Mr. Fuller states on how he really curves the ER part. Nigger, have you at any time have ever mentioned the word nigger or something like that? And then the white guy openly lied, and he said, play the tape, you know, because all of it was on tape and whatnot. So it really didn't matter to a whole lot of non-white black people whether he killed that white woman and white male or not, in my opinion. It was just the whole idea that even unconsciously, a lot of black people are fed up with the racism, but we don't have the means to effectively counter racism, white supremacy. So that was kind of like to a lot of non-white black people a punch back, so to speak, at that particular time. So I was working, but I was not on duty. I was not on duty at the time when the verdict came out. But I did notice a quiet, unusual quietness that was going on in the station when I came back to work on the issue. As far as that concern, out of white people, although O.J. Simpson was not, he would openly say some things that would indicate his lack of interest into the subject of racism, but that's not unusual for non-white black people totally right now. You know, but nevertheless, like I said, you know, he was an icon. He was an icon to black people, so it was a lot of, okay, we got our punch back, so to speak, to the consensus of black people as far as they're concerned with the trial in itself. One thing I do notice, you know, because I am involved with football, if you try to find O.J. Simpson, quote-unquote, as a football player, what he did as a football player on the computer, now, you know, the computer, it's vastly full of all kinds of information about a person, especially a person of his magnitude. Almost exclusively, the only part of O.J. Simpson you would see is either that trial or something got to do with him being in prison. Almost nothing anymore about him as a football player. And I think that's a deliberate activity that's been taking place, definitely in sports. You hardly hear his name when you're talking about some of the greatest football players that ever lived. He certainly is one of them. But you hardly hear anybody talk about that. I believe the father and the family of the ex-wife got a lifetime chip on their shoulders of hate towards him, and the father of the slain white male owns almost all of O.J. Simpson's estate, as far as what I figure. And you know, that's basically what I gather about the trial and how everything went. It was on TV almost every day, and for me, I grew tired of it. I grew tired of it, and it didn't really matter to me on whether or not I didn't care anything about the white female and the white male anyway, personally. Whether or not he did it or not did it or not, you know, it didn't really matter to me as far as that concerned. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I think that the gentleman that you were talking about, was that Robert Kardashian, who you said was the white male, the defense attorney for O.J.?
No. It was an older white male. I just can't. If you said his name, I remember that name, but I. Somebody said his name.
Robert Shapiro.
No, Bailey. F.E. Bailey.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes. When he came with that, what I suspect, see, what that tells me about white people, they know who the racists are. Some of these white people like Effie Bailey, who pretends to be basically a person who is interested in solving the problem of racism, they know who the racists are. They know how to expose them, but. It seems as though when they come on the program, we can't get them to give us any of that information of how to do, you know, that sort of thing. We can't get that out of white people when you get them one on one. You know, as far as all it does for me, it confirms for me of white people's insincerity into solving the problem.
Mm-hmm. I would say on.
I was just about to say, because he got that information out of him in a very short period of time.
And pointed out the deception along the way, which is something else you can look for in the system of white supremacy, white people lying about practicing racism and other things. I was just going to point out Mr. Josh Wickett, he's been a guest on the program before and has written about racism, white supremacy repeatedly. He said this years ago, I think more than a decade ago, he said that the second strongest motivating force is sexual intercourse. First strongest motivating force, racism, white supremacy. And he said, you already see, it's obvious, the ubiquitous means of using sex to promote and sell products. He said, eventually, I think it's going to be just blatantly appealing to racism, white supremacy, like explicitly, not the indirect ways, just explicitly appealing to racism, white supremacy to sell products, that's what it's going to be eventually. I think this O.J. Simpson movie, American Crime, I think that might be what this is. It's going to be a lot more racial theater in terms of it's going to be entertainment things that are directly about racism. Because I was confused. I think it's American Crime, the O.J. Simpson trial or whatever it is. But there's already a television show that's called American Crime that's about racism. I think it's a white female and a white male get killed and they lock up a black guy and he's in a sexual relationship with this white woman. And the whole thing is about racism. It's almost the O.J. Simpson trial just without it being a celebrity. The victims, the white male, his parents are upset, and the white woman, she like begins appealing to racism, white supremacy, like you got these illegals and coming in and killing people and rah, 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 and all that. It's explicitly about racism. And I think they had an episode of Scandal, I think last year, that took a lot of the storyline from Ferguson. I think they did the same thing with How to Get Away with Murder of Viola Davis, where they had an episode where it was about some racist white guy who was gentrifying the neighborhood. I think it's going to be more and more of that sort of thing. Not that white people are going out of the business of practicing racism, but just, hey, we can get people to watch. They'll come and they'll watch, like, oh, this is about Black Lives Matter, or oh, this is about O.J. Simpson, or whatever else, however else it comes up. I suspect there probably are going to be even more of these like documentaries, where they did one last year about Jordan Davis. And they did Fruitvale Station a little bit before that, a few years before that, with Ryan Coogler. I suspect it's going to be even more, where they might have the Sandra Bland story, or the Akai Gurley trial, or, I mean, it'll just go on and on and on and on and on. I'm surprised they don't have a Trayvon Martin miniseries at some point. I suspect it's just going to be more of that, because they know people will watch and they'll get upset and people will debate and they can have college classes on it. They can make money, it'll get attention, and they will just confuse non-white people about racism, white supremacy, because even though, yes, they will be talking about it, they won't do it accurately. It'll be enough non-racist white people in it, and they'll probably have some racist black people in it or what have you, that are, you know, new Black Panther Party or something like that, a caricature or something like that, to just add confusion. So, yes, racism is being discussed, but it's still being done in a way that promotes confusion so that non-white people don't really get an accurate grasp of what this is and why this is happening. But I think it's going to be more of this sort of content. And I just say that as a cautionary note about whether it's even worth your time and energy, because I think Thomas in New York, I think he said that he was not going to be continuing to watch this series. I haven't seen any of it at all. I've heard people talking about it and all of that stuff. And that was the thought process that I had as to why I wasn't even investing time to watch it. Just my general stance, reading is better than watching television, but that's what I was thinking. I just don't think that we need to sit down and watch every one of these shows or movies or whatever else that they come out with. We already did our 3 hours, basically. We will be back Friday, book club. The half has never been told. We are almost done. I think we should have two, max three, but it might just be two sessions left. We'll have to see how much we cover this week. But it should be great. Tune in, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The half has never been told, and we'll have the compensatory call-in on Saturday. Looking forward to that. Hopefully they'll have a decision in the Akai Gurley trial so we can discuss how all of that played out by the weekend and anything else that pops up. If you have suggestions, problems, gripes, confusion, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. If you can't find something in the archives or you have a guest suggestion, whatever the case may be, if you need clarification about something that was said on the program, just drop an email and I will do my best to clear it up. Feel free to email again if it was some information. If you did not get a reply, as I've said before, sometimes they get lost or whatever happens. We had a listener in the Florida area. I think I already contacted retired firefighter. We had a listener in the Florida area, southern Florida area specifically. If there are Florida listeners who would be interested in connecting with other listeners in the South Florida area, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I will forward the information. We had a listener down there who was hoping to reach out, either email or phone, or if you all are close enough, you know, maybe you can go have a beverage, non-alcoholic beverage, and, you know, chat for a little while in a constructive manner. But she was hoping to do so. Black female, just drop me a line and I will pass the information along. Or, and that goes for anywhere else, just make sure you put in the subject matter contact. In this case, it would be contact Florida. If you're someplace else in the world, just put contact, you know, contact London, contact Toronto, contact LA, wherever you happen to be at, and I will see if I can connect you. With that, we are fundraising 2016 Invest. If you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and kept us on the air for almost a decade. I hope the program has been constructive and helping folks get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. That said, sobriety would be best under conditions of war. Let's not be around intoxicated whites. I even discourage being around intoxicated victims of racism. We already have enough problems. We do not need additional strife in our lives. If you're going to be behind the wheel, even as a passenger or pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. Race soldiers are constantly looking to terrorize and cause us problems. You do not want to be intoxicated when you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson. You want to be lucid, clear thinking, so you can make the best possible decisions to keep yourself safe, you and any people that you might be responsible for. With that, thanks all for tuning into the program. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim. Man.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.